In return for Exeter's astonishing generosity in making me a doctor, let me give you youngsters a present. 5 mantras. Five mantras to carry with you through your lives. These are mine. These are what have helped me not only to survive, but to be happy. Yeah? Now remember these. Remember these. All men are equal. Therefore, what are you laughing at? All men, number one, all men are equal. Therefore, no one can ever be your genuine superior. Number two, it is your future. It is yours to create. Your future is as bright as you make it. Number three, change is a constant of life. So you must never, ever lose your wisdom. Your wisdom that you nurtured and enriched here at Exeter University. Number four, if you want to live a full and complete human life, you have to be free. Freedom is paramount. And number five, love is the answer. Love is the answer. So, my friends, there's my present to you. You just make sure that you've always got those five things: equality, opportunity, wisdom, freedom, and love. Yeah? Equality, opportunity, wisdom, freedom, and love. And you'll be all right. You'll be all right. With that and a bit of good luck. So good luck. Congratulations and good luck, my young friends. You go out there and have yourselves a good life.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 30th of August, 2024. Streaming live from Eastone Studios in Bristol, which with London's Inner Temple is one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton in Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Available free from all good app stores, please use Aurora, not Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant celeb distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes, really failing completely to do its job, although billions and billions of pounds is going round within the London media. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against World War III and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, twisted Armageddonists craftily crafting it to make every crisis worse. Nick Land's behaviourist Dark Enlightenment drones, cowards and control freaks, want us slaves to their AI. Make it worse, if it couldn't already be, Albert Pike's World War III relies on your blind obedience. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and vampire queen Camilla wage war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS, kind of painting themselves into a corner, aren't they? It's not the end of the world, or is it? So, helping us navigate the accelerationist Fourth Reich matrix in a minute will be Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. But we're joined now by freelance journalist Joe Banks. Hi, Joe.
Hi there.
By way of introduction, tell us what drew you to journalism.
I think it's I don't know, I guess I used to be a bit high and mighty. It's a challenge to try and tell the truth. It's a way of exploring the world and trying to make sense of it.
It's a big word, truth, isn't it? A big word.
Yeah, difficult. I guess it's a difficult word. It's hard, but that's the challenge when you're trying to write something.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you see something which you think you can understand and see, the big challenge for me is trying to actually articulate it, and sometimes it takes a long time. I got back on Tuesday evening with just the thought of doing something about rewilding, an introduction piece to it, and at 3 o'clock in the morning I finally finished my what was going to be a couple of paragraph introduction. So the idea really here is to take the trouble to articulate what you can see in your mind and actually get that down on paper. It's quite awkward. So for you, you've been working, I know, with Vice. We're going to be talking first about what's going on in Bristol. Mm. That's quite an interesting... This is a lot of this online media, it seems to me, to be where it's happening, not in the old London legacy press. Mm.
Well, I mean, it's a funny thing with Vice, because they became this sort of huge global media empire. Started out in the 90s as a sort of little hipster magazine in Canada, and this guy Shane Smith built this global media empire of doing a sort of edgy alternative type of media, and then the whole thing got so massive and overstretched that it sort of collapsed, and it looked like the whole thing was on the verge of collapse, and then they basically went bankrupt last year. There are lots of different strands. There's a TV station and different stuff. But basically, they got some sort of hedge fund stepped in and bought the Vice.com journalism bit. And they've got an old editor back in, and it's keeping going. So,
this is always the worry to me is always that the owners. Who is it that owns the printing presses? Who is it that owns the transmitters? Mm. Who is it that, in this case, that owns the domain? The intellectual property, and all that sort of thing. Well, we're also joined in the studio by Isaac Newbane Hopkins. Hi, Isaac.
Hello. How's it going? Sorry, I'm late.
You're not. Yeah, we're just about, well, we do Joe first and you, so you just about managed to get in here on time.
Yes.
Maybe you can answer a similar question, Isaac, about what drew you to journalism, because, I mean, a lot of us aspire to it, but what is it that made you think, this is where I need to be?
So, I think that is an interesting question. It was something I was always kind of interested in, I think, like, as a kid, and telling those sort of stories. I mean, sometimes there's that kind of slightly glib answer of, speaking truth to power. But I did have some kind of slightly idealistic belief in that. And it got sort of sidetracked by getting involved in politics as soon as I moved out, so about the age of 19. And being involved in sort of left-wing politics, which meant I was deemed, an unbiased news source. So I wasn't allowed to read emails for free on a midnight radio show at BBC Bristol because I said I'd like Jeremy Corbyn. That kind of put it on hold. And I think for me now, it's not quite that idealistic view. I do think there's these huge limitations. And I think lots of, journalism is not speaking truth to any power. It's cozying up with it. But I think it can be used as a way to kind of channel kind of political ideas and these sort of political currents that are happening. And, so much stuff is done on Twitter now, which is sort of useless, beyond useless. It makes us stupider and it makes us more confused. So being able to actually take these important ideas and these ideas that are important to me and I think other people through Corbynism and that sort of stuff and have them laid out in a kind of longer form way, more thoughtful way, so that they can then be used to be acted on. That's kind of what drew me to it, I think.
Joe mentioned the word truth. Does that feature in your panopticon of journalism?
I strive to always tell the truth. You kind of get into this slippery business with it, I think, in that, because it's not always about the truth, is it? I think most journalists would say they mostly tell the truth. I think often what they'll do is not tell you the whole truth. It's the omissions. And I that's where the kind of ideology sort of slips in mostly. There's some particularly egregious examples of, journalists willfully lying. But often I think they think they are telling the truth.
And I mean, we keep hearing about fake news, don't we? But I know I always immediately start thinking weapons of mass destruction, Iraq. You know, we're being accused, a lot of freelancers particularly, oh, you're spreading fake news. A lot of social media influence, whatever, you're spreading fake news. But the really big fake news, it seems to me, comes from London. It comes from the billion, you know, the big transmitters, the big printing presses. Anyway, look, Joe, I know you take a great interest in planning. I do too here in Bristol, because this is the future of the city, really, we're talking about. It's also about do the citizens of Bristol get a priority in all this, or is it the big developers? Because the big developers just want to build big, and they want to build central, and they want to build what they want to build. And actually, there's supposed to be a bit of pushback from the council. We saw, didn't we, earlier this year, the government stepping in and actually taking away some of Bristol City Council's planning powers because they said we're basically not competent.
Yeah, that was mainly about the backlog. So it was that they weren't getting the developments, you know, the applications done quick enough. I'm drawn to it because, a lot of it is going on under the surface. There's not a lot of good coverage of it to actually find out what's really going on.
Yeah, what you get is an announcement, basically like a press release, saying this building has got planning approval, a nice sort of glossy picture, and that's basically it.
Yeah.
And it'll always be good, and no one will ever be upset about it.
Yeah. And, there was a good example of that this week, as a sort of example of this. There's a development, a new development that got approved by Bristol City Council for a hotel, what they call an apart hotel, which is a sort of self-catering apartments in a sort of hotel-like environment, and build-to-rent flats. And this is all taking place right outside Bristol Temple Mead Station as part of the Temple Quarter development. And it's interesting, you starting out talking about Bristol as the Templar port, because goes back to the 12th century when this land by the Avon was given to the Knights Templars. But we spin on through the centuries, the biggest sort of regeneration site in Bristol is Temple Quarter, this development comes through, it's flagged, you know, this shiny new thing's got approval. But you then look into the officer's report that they have to produce, and you can see that there's a big disagreement has gone, big sort of fight has gone on between different parts of the planning department, and the council's transport officers have recommended it for refusal. What this development is going to undermine long-held plans for a pedestrian and cycling route along the harbour side there.
Right, and this will be right in the way. So yeah. The point is here, planning is about people looking long-term, saying, right, if you're going to do some buildings and things, they need to be here and here, not there, because it's a bit like when the railways were closed down. Initially, they were saying, well, actually, this railway might reopen, so please don't build a massive tower block on the middle of the railway.
Because it won't
be able to reopen unless it goes through your tower block. So this is what planning is all about, isn't it?
Yes,
the idea is you're looking ahead.
It's about the power of who comes out on top? Who just what are the rules? What's the rules of the game? But then who ends up, you know, massaging those rules and making it work out for them? So it's, you know, it's very interesting when you get into something like this Temple Quarter regeneration project, which is also an enterprise zone. And then you've got to start getting into what is an enterprise zone, where have enterprise zones come from? Hmm. And you start to unpick, you start to get into the detail of, you know, how the society around us has been structured.
Yeah, it came from deindustrialisation, a lot of it. I mean, I was working in London when there were all the controversy around building the Docklands Airport came in, because they're saying, well, listen, there's thousands, tens of thousands of people living around here. We don't want an airport in the middle of our community. This is in North Woolwich and around that area. And because it was an enterprise zone, Thatcher, I think it was the London Dockland Development Corporation, it was called, they could just do what they wanted. There didn't seem to be any planning rules. Well, it's like, if you own the land, you can do what you want.
Docklands was the first enterprise zone and the trailblazer. And as these zones of deregulation, where you have, you slash taxes and you relax the planning laws. So that, you know, that's what's gone on in Bristol this week, is that rather than these planning applications going to democratically elected councillors, because it's in an enterprise zone, they can just be signed off by officers. And it's, the whole history of Docklands and the enterprise zones goes back to Geoffrey Howe, who was Margaret Thatcher's chancellor, giving a speech in 1978 to a conservative think tank called the Bow Group, and talking about these places where the free market could flourish, and this was what we'd do to the problem of cities in Britain and deindustrialisation.
Well, I also remember that era, the Herald of Free Enterprise ferry sinking that had just been privatised. I remember that it was a cross-channel ferry. The Herald of Free Enterprise, glug, glug, glug. Mm. Quite a few people lost their lives, but the point is made. Look, what is this whole free enterprise thing all about? This guy, by the way, who's the new chief executive, or I think maybe he's an interim, he's also from London, isn't he, this chap Paul Martin?
Yeah, and he ties into this because he spent over a decade at Wandsworth Council, who were the trailblazing council in London for Thatcherism, and got, you know, these ideas going in local government of outsourcing and selling off council housing and basically pushing poor people out of Wandsworth. And then you had this sort of the most egregious example of this sort of developer free-for-all development in London, which was Nine Elms, which is this kind of forest of skyscrapers that's now between Vauxhall and Battersea, beside the Thames, full of empty luxury flats that have been sold off to foreign investors. Hardly any affordable housing at all. The affordable housing that's been built there.
Is this on the, South Bank or the North Bank?
South, between Battersea and Vauxhall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it included Battersea Power Station and this development called Embassy Gardens, where the US Embassy went. And this chap, Paul Martin, was the chief executive of Wandsworth through this whole period from 2010 to 2021. And the man who appointed him was Sir Edward Lister, and it was pretty much the last thing. Well, he's now Lord, actually. He's in the House of Lords. But the last thing he did as the leader of Wandsworth Council was appoint this chap, Paul Martin, to be the chief executive. And then Lister went on to join Boris Johnson in City Hall and became his deputy and became responsible for planning in London, and did all kinds of, you know, really corrupt things, including coming back as the chair of one of the Malaysian developers who were building Nine Elms. You know,
corrupt. Corrupt. Surely, I mean, so the idea here is you've got a little deal going on with a massive property speculator developer. You give them the planning permission they want, then they appoint you to the board on a massive salary.
Mm. And he was doing things. He was doing things like he gave. I mean, he all yeah. And he he approved this big approval for Delancey as part of the Olympic development, and then went on to be a director and advisor for them a couple of years later, and he's done that loads of times, and then he became when Johnson left City Hall, he became chair of Homes England, which is a sort of arm's length government regeneration body, that was the point where he was receiving these massive consultancy fees from this Malaysian developer EcoWorld.
I think it'd be quite nice on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to put up a little timeline connected with Lister and Martin, Joe.
That's the background. I mean, and then when Martin left Wandsworth, you know, once all this development had been done, he's just sort of moving around from on these sort of short-term contracts from place to place. He went to Jersey for about 6 months. He was a sort of interim chief executive in the Jersey Authority, you know, which is the tax haven. And actually, quite a few of these big developers are registered in Jersey. Even the, you know, the ones working on Nine Elms, whether there's a connection there or not, I don't know. But and he was in LA for a while. He's working for a management consultancy in LA. And who knows how long he'll be in Bristol. Obviously, he's on fabulous money.
What's his salary?
Well, in Wandsworth, back, you know, a decade ago in Wandsworth, he was on about 230. In 2014, he was on 230 grand a year. So he definitely won't be getting less than that now.
Isaac, can I just bring you in here? Because it really does seem to me as if there's two major problems here. One is you've got an enormous difference between what the local residents want and what these people are providing in terms of these massive developments right in the centres of their cities. And the other thing is that there is actually no... there doesn't seem to be any kind of proper governance going on. So, for example, with the revolving doors, backwards and forwards. And you end up with... it really does feel like the democracy is shriveled and died.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, right? I mean, the idea of these kind of these zones. There's a really interesting book called, I think, Cracked Up Capitalism, something like that. Can't remember the author, but he talks about the way these are used and there was examples in like Hong Kong was one example where
that was a big inspiration. Hong Kong was a big inspiration, yes, for this guy called Peter Hall. He was actually started off as a sort of lefty libertarian guy, and this idea developed through the 70s. And then was latched on by the sort of the proto-Thatcherite people.
Yeah, it's flipping these left-wing ideas on their heads. You know, the same way as lots of, like, the sort of recent conservative cabinets had, like, Lenin busts and things. These kind of using some kind of left-wing ideas and then flipping them around. And, like, they're ways of, like, you know, people complain about red tape. But an idea of red tape in its positive aspect is to make sure these things work for the community they're in, make sure that actually these flats built might have some affordable places to live, might, you know, increase the stock of social housing in the city, which is something that we're hugely lacking. But instead, in the name of just sort of progress or development, we kind of get these awful kind of usually ugly buildings.
Surely it's just profit, isn't
it? Yeah. And they make everything harder and more difficult while we're being told, well, isn't it great? Bristol's now got really tall buildings. We didn't used to have that. And you go, well, it doesn't actually really affect my life that we've got some tall buildings now. It seems to have made it more difficult to get around. It means less money is going into sort of, you know, transport when more people are using it. And it's not increasing the stock of, like, social housing. These kind of mechanisms that we're told are for progress are just constantly used to kind of remove these... you know, mechanisms of democratic oversight, which are there for a reason, if usually imperfect, like in practice. But we just end up, it just ends up making everything that much worse. I mean, I'm from Cardiff and we're kind of that much further down the road, I think, of tall, horrible, ugly buildings, where the actual character of this kind of historic city, Bristol's a funny one, I guess, because it was, you know, quite a lot of it was bombed flat and was not necessarily built back with beauty in mind.
The centre was, certainly. Yeah.
And but, you know, in Cardiff, you see it now where it's just like, you know, none of my friends can afford to live anywhere near sort of central Cardiff, even though we're sort of not, didn't grow up that far away, and we all have to move further out.
I mean, we've got a green administration now. The new chief executive is like the high priest of gentrification.
I mean, it's often the way, isn't it? Because they're dressed up as good liberals doing good liberal things, and yet the actual impact of their policies, despite, you know, whatever lanyards they might be wearing to work, are so often things that make the lives of ordinary people much more difficult.
But I feel more and more that the local government, the councillors, I mean, the councillors of both they don't really understand the system they're part of. You know, there's this very complex world that's going on within councils, you know, within these different organisations of these other bodies like the West of England Mayoral Authority, all these partnerships with private sector actors, and these councillors are sort of floating around with a few ideas, but I don't think they have any purchase on how the thing is working. And I got a sense of that. You know, it's not a personal dig or anything, but I actually, even just today, I was asking on Twitter to the Green councillor Rob Breyer, who's the chair of one of the planning committees, and asking him. You know, I'm unclear about what exactly, you know, what the rules are around planning for these enterprise zones. You know, and I sort of asked him whether he could enlighten me. And he's actually a guy who I think studied planning at university, but he said he didn't know, and he was going to ask the officers about it.
I think a lot of this is by design, though, right? Like this increasing use of these short term contracts among people who are higher up, so that they can't actually become part of the workings.
But isn't
of
the idea
democracy?
Of him being on a short term is that we've got a new administration that they will probably want to find someone of their own rather than take a legacy person?
But I think we see this sort of across the board, right? Like the new CEO of the zoo is, you know, something I've been looking into recently, and he has this history of these very short term jobs. People come in to like make these big changes, then they leave before anyone gets too angry at them. The council is increasingly using consultants, which means actually any knowledge that is accrued through these processes of development can't be held by the council. It's out there. So the councillors then don't have someone that they can go to without paying them a lot of money to go, how does this work? And, you know, these consultants are then also working for the development companies. There's like by design, and the kind of marketization of local government, they've made it's a de-skilling. It's the same way as, like, you know, automation, when people used to like be like craftsmen. Like, by automating the process of local government through constant outsourcing, it means none of that knowledge can develop, so that the people who have all the knowledge and all the power are the people who want to make money off it, rather than the people who are elected and hired by us.
Coming in to do a kind of to wield the hatchet, and then they're off. I mean, this is very similar to central government, isn't it? There's been a national discussion over the last couple of weeks about cronyism, where people being put into civil service jobs who've got no civil service background. The idea seems to be this is jobs for their mates, basically jobs for the boys, jobs for their friends, rather than somebody who's got. I mean, it must be rather galling to work your way up through the civil service and then to have someone from outside just brought in over your head, Isaac.
Yeah, no, I can imagine it probably is. I mean,
But isn't it like a privatisation of the... It's almost like it's not... There is no public service culture anymore. Sorry, guys, but we need to make money. We're really in difficult financial circumstances, so forget all that serving the public business. We want to bring in some private sector people. They'll get it done.
Well, the new Labour government, I think the MPs are the most, like, highest percentage of lobbyists we've had in a kind of government. Like, there is this kind of culture change in what is deemed politics. Partly it's, you know, weirdos who've never been on the internet, so no one can hold anything against them. Or people who've wanted to be an MP since they're about four, which should, in my opinion, you know, disallow you from any political power. But I think they are the symptom of what we now deem politics, which is a kind of technocratic one way to do it. You know, there was some pushback against this. Like the Brexit vote, I think, was a pushback, an attempted pushback against that. Although I don't think it was then utilised or, like, followed through on to actually make that difference and make increased democracy in the UK. But I think, yeah, the new Labour government and them hiring their mates is a symptom of this kind of political culture, which is that basically you should, you're meant to be a PR guy and someone who can make a nice, if meaningless, speech that impresses your local party or whatever and gets you into a position of power. If you believe something, that's a mark against your name. as we're seeing with the way that even sort of quite centrist MPs are falling foul of Starmer by having their occasional red line of, oh, I actually do believe in this one thing. Well, that's not allowed. It's this complete gutting of any politics from politics, which is perverse, in my opinion.
Yeah, Joe, I don't know if you mind me mentioning this, but you were just talking about transport a little bit there in the city. I couldn't resist this. 2 days in a row here, there are local paper, the Bristol Post. I've got copies in my hand here. This is Tuesday's. It says, bus boss is banned from running buses. Big penalty for former head of Transpora. So the idea is we have First Bus here in Bristol running almost everything. So a new bus company comes in, but the guy allegedly, I mean, it just seems to me like the cartel doesn't want him and it's booted him out somehow. So he's gone. Next day we get marooned. Residents say they're stuck. Bus services axed. So we've got this ridiculous situation where we're being told that the cars are no longer allowed in the city centre. They're trying to stop that completely, but you can ride a bike in. And by the way,
you might have to go around a development.
Yes, but there's whole slices of the outer parts of the city, like Long Ashton, for example, now that there's no buses at all. So, and it's a little bit insulting to tell, say, for example, pensioners, you've got to just forget your car, you've got to go on a bike or whatever, especially in the middle of winter when the wind is against you, you know, and it's pouring with rain. There's something very backward about this. It's almost like
none of it joins up, you know. So you have different, you know, this is one of the things about this development I was talking about this week that got approval, but it completely undermines these long-held transport plans, which it seems, you know, the transport officers in the council have tried to fight against, but unsuccessfully, because they're up against bigger forces. And, you know, and so the idea, you know, for years now, we've been told that the thing is city centre living and people getting around by walking and cycling and public transport and get rid of the cars. But when you have a program trying to make walking and cycling sort of easy and an attractive thing to do in the city, that is just thrown to one side if a developer would rather build their flats having a riverside view without, you know, people moving around underneath the balconies.
So one of the things you're also pointing out is universities and the city is actually a big increase in population. This is keeping the house prices very high in Bristol, but the universities are completely banking, aren't they, on all these new students coming in next month?
Yeah, I mean that's a big bubble that's bound to burst at some point.
Why?
I don't think it's sustainable, or something will happen in the world where you know, you can't have, there are not going to be loads and loads of Chinese young people wanting to come and study in Britain.
Maybe they'll set up their own universities from the Chinese-speaking people who've come over here, and then all the Chinese will start going to their own universities rather than to ours. Yeah. What do you make of this massive population increase, Isaac? Mainly through this field by students.
Mixed feelings. You know, as someone who came here as a student many years ago now, so I think I've done my time to prove I'm not one of them. But it's difficult. I think you're right that the university sector has been set up as a bubble. Like, kind of the way that fees were set up means that now actually the fees that British students pay doesn't cover their courses. So universities are increasingly reliant now on international students, while every government, because no government or party is willing to actually try and make the case for, you know, some migration, every government campaigns on, we're going to have less people move here. But then the more hostile you are towards people moving here, it makes it increasingly difficult for these universities, which in many places are, you know, the main employer. Bristol, I'm not sure it is, but still one of the big employers and one of the big sort of revenue streams into the city. And yeah, you're right. And it is, you know, a large part of that is based on Chinese students, while our government is, you know, very keen to be very loud about the fact that it's being increasingly hostile towards China, which you know, if a large industry was reliant on not being very hostile towards China, you'd think they might think twice. But never let PR get in the way of, you know, people's well-being. And I think it, I mean, it's difficult. We're seeing, I mean, Bedminster now, which when I moved here as a student, you were sort of told you wouldn't want to go there. Now they're having this massive influx of new student flats. They're not going to be ready in time for Freshers Week, which I think people will find quite disappointing when they move here. I mean, and just, was it last year, the year before, where there were so many people, they couldn't house them all and they had to send a bunch of them to Newport? And things like that, where the experience that is, you're being sold as the education is becoming, you know, degrees are being less and less good these days, as the actual people who teach you are being worked to the bone, have less and less time to teach you. Like, what we're offering is a less good offer going forwards, but we're reliant on increasing numbers of people coming to a country they might never have been to before to purchase that from us. That obviously, there's so many contradictions in that that it can't last. And we're going to end up in a load of flats that are designed for people who are only going to live there a year and wouldn't complain about them because they're only there a year and they know they can get out. And then at some point, someone's going to be like, well, maybe we should repurpose these for places, you know, people might live for longer than that. And I don't know if they're fit for purpose for that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we're going to end up with just a load of empty, ugly flats in like, that aren't actually properly provided for by public transport or anything like that. It's, I mean, they're already finding now that there aren't buses from Bedminster to the universities where they're being sort of, we're expecting to go and learn. It's going to be a massive faff for them to go from this place they're being dumped. Like, it's all of it. It's not being thought through. It's not, and the people in charge of these universities are not thinking it through beyond their year-on-year kind of accounts, which allows them to kind of do increasing cuts, massively undermine the education that they're offering, the quality of the education, and it's just getting worse for everyone involved, except for the people at the top who are earning increasing amounts of money.
Well, also ought to point out, you're in the, isn't it the UCU?
I currently work for the UCU, yes, hence my
which stands for the University and College Lecturers Union, is that something like that?
Yeah, University and College Union, because it's mostly academics, but there's a large part of like non-academics, like administrative and they call professional services stuff, people who work with academics often.
So it's becoming very, very, very commercialized, the whole university scene. It seems to me completely different to when I was at university back in the early 1980s, completely different. And you've got all sorts of tensions because of that as well. So the key thing here is these student loans are a guaranteed form of income for the universities, aren't they? So there's no kind of pretense of this being something that they're offering in a genuinely competitive way, because these loans are guaranteed to the students and the debt that they're saddled with. Do you think that's got something to do with the suicide rate here in Bristol? How's that? Because I look at these students and they think this is the right thing to do, to go to university, and they suddenly realise they're not getting as good a quality learning as they wanted, and they're also not sure if they actually want that, to take that career path. They've just sort of gone into it because there's no, you know, other path. There doesn't seem to be any work for them when they leave school.
I think that kind of, that sort of increase in depression and mental illness, I think some of that is down to, this feeling that you're being saddled with this debt. But also, actually, I think it's as much about the ways that the support structures within the university are being cut. Like, the people whose job it was to make sure that you were okay and look after your well-being, and that would be people who were, like, you know, counsellors, but also, like, academics actually having the time and headspace to be like, well, that person has disappeared, maybe I should chase that up. And I mean, that's changed massively since, I mean, when I was a student and I had, you know, some mental health problems, that people actually did get in touch with me and go, you seem to have disappeared. Yeah. What's going on? And I did, because I was the first year where you had to pay.
Right.
And like the massive decline, even since then, what, like 10 years ago? Like the massive decline. I mean, it shows what actually allowing these mechanisms into an industry can do, and very rapidly undermine these things, as we're seeing with housing, as well as education, as we're seeing with transport. Like, these things can get really bad really quickly if we allow the kind of allow the market to kind of cannibalise them from the inside.
That's right. I mean, it's pretty fair to say students do have a good time as well. They know how to really get drunk, not necessarily get drunk, but enjoy themselves.
Well, that was part of my problem, if I'm honest.
get too much alcohol. Well, look. Joe, what about the university's role in the planning in the city? Because they do seem to be a major kind of figurehead. They've also managed to grab this nice piece of land, prime site next to Temple Meads as well for their campus. And which, that's all starting being built now, I think.
Which is, I mean, they've been absolutely central to how the early phases of this Temple Quarter regeneration project has developed. Which it should be said, even though this has been going on for years now, there's still no master plan. They're producing one now, but they still haven't got a master plan for the whole thing. But these plots and areas are being picked off one by one. But the crucial thing at the start of it was the university buying the land that was the old Royal Mail sorting office beside Temple Mead Station, and that had the knock-on effect then of kiboshing the long-held plans for the arena. Because, you know, I don't think the university wanted to have an arena next to their new enterprise campus, and it's this enterprise campus is an interesting phenomenon because it's going to be this strange, meeting of cutting edge research and business. So it's going to be sort of another one of these shining examples of the marketization of, you know, the universities.
Well, it's both. It wasn't this. I mean, there's this sort of technology hub up at Emerson's Green as well, which is also attached to the university. I don't know how much you guys know about that, but that seems to be, it already quite well catered for here in Bristol. Maybe it's just that's connected with UWE, and this is this other sector is part of the university. But I mean, look, in the background to all of this, we've got a rather, poor council who seem to be, well, in fact, the announcement this week is that the Greens don't know how bad Bristol City Council finances were. Have you heard that one before? Until coming to power. And the Green council leader, Tony Dyer, who I'm quickly starting to christen Dyer Tony, is a new council leader warns of bankruptcy threat. So, this, Joe, maybe you could just start with this. Look, the council's going bankrupt. Maybe that's why the developers are getting their way here across the city.
Yeah, it certainly makes things easier for them. And the whole thing has gone in tandem, hasn't it? You get a very run-down, weak, local government, or you get mayoral systems, which at their heart are there to simplify things for the private sector, really, and get that private investment and capital moving into cities. But the strange the strange thing with Bristol City Council now is that there's no really no accountability. I mean, under the mayoral system, you had no councillors were completely sidelined. But now, under this committee system, where you don't have a formal administration, there's no real ultimate accountability, and so you keep getting the Greens now saying we're not in charge. You get Labour saying you're the administration in coalition with the Liberal Democrats, and the Greens are saying no one's in charge. We're all in this together on our committees.
It is the most.
Because you said something about this, didn't you? In fact, you wrote something, I think, for the Cable, Isaac, before we had a change of administration in May.
Yes.
About what is this new council going to look like? So, what do you make of these? I just wanted to put it in context. Be interesting to see how you think they're getting on. If they're saying, well, actually, look, it's not just the Green Party here; we're all in it together. This is how Marvin started out, and it didn't last long. That did it.
I think, it's the most Green Party thing ever to have a political system that is your national policy to implement, to win it in the city, then take power, and to then not have a solid idea of how it works or how you'll use it to leverage what are your political aims and ambitions. Like, say what you want about the Labour Party, but if they were pushing for a political system and it had got in, they would be ready to use it to do what they want. What they want to do might not be good, but they would be ready. I mean, we saw that with Marvin. Marvin, I think, was someone ready to be the mayor. I've just started reading his autobiography, and he was ready very early on to be the mayor and knew what he was going to do with it. And I think the Greens now have gotten this situation where they didn't seem ready for power. They didn't seem ready for the Labour Party. And the Labour Party in the South West is very adept at attacking and disrupting forces it considers to its left, which it considers the Greens to be. It's been doing that for decades. I mean, long history of undermining any project to its left and containing that energy. And now the Greens are coming up against what those of us who were, you know, involved in Corbynism, involved in the Labour left back then, saw, which is that the Labour are very good at utilising bureaucratic levers presented to them, identifying them and using them to disrupt. And it's been disappointing to see the Greens do that. I was hoping there might be a secret plan, but I don't think there was. I've sort of spoken to people who were involved in the Brighton Greens who have told me they tried to warn the Bristol Greens about when you take power, it'll be like this. And they were, oh no, everything here will be fine. You know, we're very friendly with them. And it's...
Well, Jude English, who was on this programme just around about the time of the local elections, was saying that she... Because she's been ejected by them. She was a long-term councillor who's helped them get into the position where they are now in Ashley Ward, which is around St Paul's area in the city centre. And she called them the toy party that they're playing at being in government.
I think that's true.
And when I approached Rob Breyer, Joe, to come on this programme to talk about some of these things, and he is just very, very, very evasive. He's messaging me saying... thanks, Tony. It's a pass from me unless you provide proper information about your show. Okay, so I pointed out to him, you've already been on this show 5 times when we were at a different place, so I don't quite understand why you need to be told, and also there's a link. And then he sent me back another text saying you need to explain what you're doing better. Even though I sent him a link to the website, he then said, oh, the website's unavailable. I said, well, look, it's not. It's... What's the problem? So it was just a whole series of looking for an excuse not to actually engage. And so finally said, nah, not really interested in doing anything.
Whilst
he's in opposition, he's fine coming on the programme again and again. Then he pretends that he's never been on here and he's just looking for an excuse to say no.
The toy party thing you said, I think, is really interesting. Because I've noticed there's been a kind of phenomenon I've seen of people online talking about, like, oh, actually, I'm a bit busy for the next year, so I've cancelled my Green Party membership. And you're like, well, that's not how political party work. Like, you're in the political party, and sometimes you can't be active in the party, but you're still a member. And their relation to the party as a vehicle for taking and using power is weird. And, like, I think, you know, wrong-headed, I would go as far as to say.
There's a lot of people in the Labour Party that joined during Corbynism, but as soon as Starmer gets close to power, they're off.
Yeah, I think that's... That was also a problem, especially when there was time. I mean, I've now left myself, but there definitely was times where we could have cemented a certain level of power as the left in the Labour Party, and people were like, "Well, no, I don't like the vibes anymore." Me and my friends used to joke it would be like storming the Winter Palace and then leaving because the staff in the foyer were a bit mean to you. Like, there is the kind of a view of, I think, particularly on the left, because I actually think the right have a good understanding of power, like. The systems they've set up, like we've been talking about, do benefit the wealthy in this country. But I think lots of people who are more progressive don't quite understand the grubbiness of power and the way that you need to operate to do it. And I think the Greens are going to suffer from that for the next few years.
So you're predicting the same as happened in Brighton. So they get a period in power where they just sort of mess around, they get it all wrong, and then they're out.
I think there's a good chance that could happen unless they... You know, there was always going to be issues with the committee system when it began, because almost by its very nature, you could never finish it before it was implemented. There was always going to be bits where you were going to have to, like, build it as you go. That was one of the things.
But they don't seem to have any sort of really clear vision. I mean, there's no money. So what's happening is the massive hike in allotment fees that the Labour Party were trying to do beginning of this year, end of last year, and that the Greens campaigned so vehemently against and overturned, along with obviously the allotmenteers themselves, they're now back and the Greens are implementing them.
And Labour are the ones criticising them for implementing them.
This is a pantomime. It's not politics. It's not democracy. It's a pantomime. If everything is... I mean, we've also had this whole business last week, I think, wasn't it, where there's going to be an enormous hike in Thames Water's 60% they want increase in water bills, where they could simply allow Thames Water to collapse, the investors to pull out, and... renationalise it for free, for nothing. But no, the people, the good people of London are now going to have to face up to a 60% increase in their water charges. So something's going on here which is not in the interests of any of them. I mean, you've got millions of people in London who, were they given a chance, would say, renationalise it. We want to pay half the bill and not the shareholders of these private equity firms, etc. So something's gone completely wrong, isn't it? And it all seems to... to me, anyway, to be based around these utilities, public utilities like water, gas, electricity, and they're also going up. So, Mike, I don't know, Joe, if you want to say something about why is it that how have they managed to get away with this? That a massive increase in, so you've got two choices: either renationalise Thames Water, which seems to be the obvious thing to do, the natural thing to do, or you can refinance it, increase the bills by 60%, and Thames Water can just carry on. And maybe in a few years' time, you'll have another massive increase in the water bill. We're facing a cost of living crisis. There doesn't seem to be any acknowledgement about that from central government at all.
No. Talk about a lack of vision, but there's definitely a sense of a lack of vision from this new government. But there's... I mean, yeah, a 60% rise in the water costs. You know, that is that going to be stomached? You know, there's got to be a breaking point at some point.
People will be cut off.
I think
off,
people are pretty
they?
Near the end of their tether.
People will be cut off, won't they?
There was examples in, I don't know if it was Ireland or Northern Ireland, where people did en masse start refusing to pay their water fees. Mm. I think you're right. I think there is a certain point where there will have to be something will break. And I think a lot of the issues we're seeing, like with water, a prime example, where the government hollowed out the people meant to hold the private firms accountable. And now we're seeing the results of that, where actually it's been allowed to slide to the point where quite a lot of work does need to be done to fix our water system, but the private companies aren't willing to pay that. But it shouldn't have been allowed to get so far that it was so massive. I think it's the same issue we've got with allotments. There's one member of staff at the council who they've got working on it, but which means they can't implement a price rise that's kind of actually based on how big your allotment is. It has to be a flat fee because they don't have the manpower or the capacity to do it in a way that's more equitable. All the parts of government and local government that should be there to make sure that the pain is spread out in a way that it can be dealt with, or that people aren't feeling pain at all. I don't think we need to be doing austerity in the way we are.
Well, this massive local government cuts.
Yeah.
This all began in 2011 under George Osborne. This is when the local authorities were told, well, it's probably roughly 60 or 70% of your budget is going to be cut over the next 10 years. Or I think they said 5 years initially, because they didn't know they were going to be in government all that time. But slowly but surely it's been pared away. This is all put down really to 2008 and the bank bailouts, where we should have just let these banks collapse. They're private businesses, but instead all that public money went to them, and now we're massively indebted as a nation, and much of our taxes is going to pay off that debt. And so that's one of the major reasons why every time I see one of these things like a closing of a public toilet or anything else going on in local government, I'm thinking 2008. Thank you, George Osborne. We're going to round up in a minute with just a final chat with you, Joe, about your Vice article, interesting thing recently, and you, Isaac, with your you were in Cuba recently. It'd be lovely to hear what you made of that. But round off this little political chit-chat with Keir Starmer's big speech this week and just the sort of crowning crescendo to that.
Those with the broadest shoulders should bear the heavier burden. And that's why we're cracking down on non-doms. Those who made the mess should have to do their bit to clean it up. And that's why we're strengthening the powers of the water regulator and backing tough fines on the water companies that have let sewage flood our rivers, lakes and seas. But just as when I responded to the riots, I'll have to turn to the country and make big asks of you as well. To accept short-term pain for long-term good. The difficult trade-off for the genuine solution. And I know that after all that you have been through, that is a really big ask and really difficult to hear. That is not the position we should be in. It's not the position I want to be in. But we have to end the politics of the easy answer that solves nothing. But I also know that we can get through this together. Because the riots didn't just betray the sickness. They also revealed the cure, found not in the cynical conflict of populism, but in the coming together of a country. The people who got together the morning after, all around the country, with their brooms, their shovels, their trowels, and cleared up their community. They reminded us who we really are. I felt real pride in those people who cleaned up our streets, rebuilt the walls, repaired the damage. And I couldn't help thinking about the obvious parallels. Because imagine the pride we will feel as a nation when after the hard work of clearing up the mess is done, we have a country that we have built together, built to last, that belongs to every single one of us, and all of us have a stake in it. Our hard work rewarded a dozen times over, because we'll have an economy that works for everyone. An NHS not just back on its feet, but fit for the future. Streets that everyone feels safe in. No longer dependent on foreign dictators, because we're producing our own clean energy right here. And giving every child, wherever they come from, whatever their background, the chance to go as far as their talents will take them. I won't lose sight of that prize. I won't lose sight of what we were elected to do. And most importantly, I won't lose sight of the people that we were elected to do it for. You. This is our country. Let's fix it together. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, this is one of his first big speeches, Keir Starmer to the nation. It's really, introducing the new parliamentary term as everyone's coming back after the summer break. He did another sort of similar thing in Germany, which is more about foreign policy. But what do you make, Isaac? What do you make of this guy?
What he's describing is David Cameron's big society. Like, it's... there is no actual offer that the state is going to be mobilised in to help anyone. The promise is that you can... some people who somehow have free time, even though they're expected to work 40, 50 hours a week, might go and help, rebuild their neighbour's walls. Like, it's not a sustainable vision for, moving forwards. At least Tony Blair was promising us that, things could only get better. Whereas this kind of post-austerity, post-Blair, post-David Cameron version of this is things can only get worse. I mean, that's not a way to govern. It's this over knee-jerk reaction to populism, whereas it's kind of like a negative form of populism.
Well, he's just throwing bricks at populism. Joe, what do you make of Starmer and his, sort of setting out his stall there? So that sound a little bit like... Yeah, they're a bit like the Greens here in Bristol, saying it's not just us, everyone's in this together.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree with Isaac. It's just, to me, it seems a very strange way to come in into government is to say is to keep stressing your powerlessness. And
it's like the power of nightmares, that you know, Adam Curtis series, saying the politicians have lost this ability to give us any kind of vision. They're just trying to allay our great they lay out the fears and do their best to allay them, saying you know, so there's a certain superficiality to this.
But you can't be criticised if you don't promise to deliver. I think that is it. It's the same approach that was used to his sort of becoming Prime Minister. If you never promise anything, no one can be disappointed. And no, you know, led by donkeys, the political activists can't put up your promises on a billboard because you never promised anything.
Okay, so the final question to both of you, Joe first, is who is in charge if all he's doing is saying, sorry guys, nothing I can do?
Who is in charge? Well, it's the.
So it's a question Jeremy Paxman always used. I remember on good old Newsnight, he'd say, "Well, yeah, but so who's in charge?"
No one's really in charge. But obviously, you've got very powerful vested interests, who are behind, the City of London.
Edward Lister
and
corporations seems to be doing rather nicely out of it all.
And they're obviously standing behind Starmer and, saying, we're quite happy if you've got no ideas and you're not prepared to do anything.
Perfect. Yeah. Isaac, who's in charge?
Keir Starmer is in charge. He's just choosing to not do anything with that. I think, you know, we've seen the prime example being what both America and the UK have done towards the genocide in Palestine, right? They could stop it. They choose not to. There's the Howard Zinn line where he says you can't be neutral on a moving train, whereas Keir Starmer has decided he's going to stand at the front of the moving train and point onwards. Like, it's the market is moving forwards. He's just choosing, as its actual leader, as the man who could actually pull the brake, is choosing to not do anything.
There's some basic stuff, right? And it really annoys me when they're saying, oh, there's nothing. Ed Miliband particularly is very good at saying, there's nothing we could do.
Ed Miliband could do.
The people's QE. If you're printing money and you're using it to prop up share prices and asset prices, why not just give it to poor people who will then spend it and get the economy moving? Isn't this a sort of... But this was some of the things that people like John McDonnell, Richard Murphy, Jeremy Corbyn were talking about in the previous era. But I suppose this is threatening the global, you know, the World Economic Forum, the Trilateral Commission, the other things which Starmer seems to be far more interested in.
I mean, we're seeing it, like the GB Energy, that kind of thing they're talking about, of having a nationalised energy company. But then they're going to make it run by market logic. It has to be competitive in the market rather than be something that can be used to sway the market in favour of normal people, the same way council has to be.
Sell us cheap electricity. That's not the price of nuclear. I mean, another thing is, real bugbears, sorry guys, but, you know, he's all about clean energy. Nuclear is not clean, folks. Let me just tell you, it's not clean when you're digging out the uranium. It's not clean when you're reprocessing. It's not clean afterwards either. So it ain't clean. it's clean. Anyway, Joe, your article recently, you did one for Vice, didn't you, about, I think, a fascinating topic. It's one of my absolute obsessions, accelerationism and the future, futurism, if you want. Vinay Gupta is this guy I'd never heard of, but it was fascinating scrolling through your article, How to Stop the Future from Destroying Us. How did you come across him?
I first came across him a long time ago, but I think it was 2010, at a thing called the Dark Mountain Festival, which was set up by a guy called Paul Kingsnorth and another guy called Dougal Hine.
Sounds very Wicker Man.
It was in Wales, it's in Llangollen. And it was
very Wicker Man.
The idea was they were saying, you know, things are collapsing through climate for other reasons.
Economics, war.
Yes, yeah. And that there's no artistic and literary response to that, so it was that's reflecting that. So it was sort of about that. But anyway, he gave this very interesting talk there, which was he was talking about climate refugees then, and this is one of the things we talked about. I did this very wide ranging interview with him for Vice, and it's up on the it's at vice.com. You can read it. But we talked when we talked. At that point back then in 2010, he was sort of. He had this this name of a global resilience guru, and he did lots of work for think tanks and through some governments and about sort of critical infrastructure threats and pandemics and this kind of stuff,
like missiles hitting nuclear power stations.
Yes,
like extinction sort of,
yeah,
rebellion,
what happens in worst case
down?
Scenarios?
Yeah, okay.
When these disasters happen. But he was also about climate mitigation and climate refugees, but he had this background as a cypherpunk sort of in the early days of the internet. The people who in the 1990s saw the internet as a sort of antidote to American power, American state power and corporate power.
Which they saw
as reaching into all aspects of people's lives, and through cryptography and the internet, that this is how we can stay sane and speak to each other and create our own communities. So he had that background, and then he's gone back into that computing world through the blockchain, which is the technology that cryptocurrencies are based on, so Bitcoin. And he was the launch coordinator for Ethereum, which is the biggest blockchain platform, and has its own cryptocurrency, Ether, which is the second biggest cryptocurrency behind Bitcoin. But he sees, he's on the sort of the idealistic front of this,
but he's got skin in the game here. He's one of the, he's got his own kind of,
yes. So he set up his own blockchain company called Materium, and the idea is to take so cryptocurrency is all about digital assets, and it's to use this blockchain technology, which is transparent and accountable.
I suppose the question is: can this stuff be fair, or is it going to be leveraged by the people that own it and control it for their own benefit?
Well, this is the sort of battle that's going on at the moment, I think, because the world's biggest asset manager, BlackRock, is getting very sort of involved in blockchain, and he set up this company called Materium. That is looking to translate the blockchain technology into the real world and have it you have all these different applications for it in supply chain. So one of the things he talks about is that blockchain in manufacturing potentially creates a transparency that allows you to see where goods are coming from and how they're made. He talks about slave labor, but I was talking to him about that, but also about his perspective on AI, on his idea. It was interesting that I knew that he saw these social goods in this blockchain technology. But he told me that his overarching aim is still back in kind of climate mitigation, and his idea of basically getting enough money from this business to start developing cities for climate refugees. So he's talking about he's saying we're going to have hundreds of millions of climate refugees. The only way to we can deal with this is to create cities from scratch.
It seems to me, well, with the reduction of governments and less and more indebted governments, the government's getting very weak. It seems like you're going to get these kind of anarcho-capitalists taking over, someone with a currency system that controls a currency system.
Well, he talks about this idea of network states, which is very interesting in the article, which is this idea that's floating around Silicon Valley of tech elites, sort of moving out of democratic structures and setting up their own, they're setting up their own countries, basically.
Yes, as they watch nation states disappearing.
Yeah, so I think there's a real prospect of that happening.
Like The City in the City by China Melville, where you can live geographically next to one another, but you exist almost in separate.
Well, his literary reference in the article, in the interview, was William Gibson.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Yeah. William Gibson,
and so it's this idea that you get these people say coming up in somewhere, setting up somewhere, and he talks about Algeria or Mali or somewhere, and they've made a deal with the government, and they've they're sort of in the middle of the nowhere in their sort of compound. But they're doing, they start doing weird tech experiments and,
But these are our enterprise zones.
Yes, exactly. They're like little enterprise zones,
Amazing.
Unregulated. Yeah, but with really these sort of insanely smart people who were really interested in developing strange new technologies.
Yeah.
And then they start sort of leaking out of these.
But the thing is, there doesn't seem to be much regulation going on in the Western world. I don't know about other parts of the world anyway. Anyway, look, Isaac, you've been to Cuba fairly recently. And I think you were in Norway when I spoke to you. Was it last week or week before? I'd love to hear a bit, particularly about Cuba. Because this is a country which I think many of us, I've got my Che Guevara Jesus t-shirt on here, they were in the vanguard really of resistance against the US. They had this horrific business with the Bay of Pigs and so anyway, how's things going over there?
So
maybe you could just start by saying why you were there.
Well, I was there. So I was there as part of basically every year the Cuban Solidarity Campaign in Britain, which has been running for decades. Every year for May Day, they send a kind of, they're called a brigade, but a delegation of young trade unionists.
So no guns or anything?
No guns, none of that. Much more
sort of boys' brigade or something.
Much more farming. Yes, a bit like boys'
brigade.
Girls' brigade. Both genders these days. So it's been going, these sort of solidarity trips have been happening for about 60 years. So there's about 40 people from the UK. There was 300 people from about 30 countries on our camp. And these were everywhere from there was sort of Americans, there's people from South America, there was Kenyan, South African, different South American countries. Like, it was really interesting. And basically, you live on this camp for 2 weeks just outside Havana. You're involved in working in cooperative farms. We went to the parliament, got a speech from the president, went to the May Day celebration in Havana, which this year was very rolled back. Usually there's a million people there. They're like, there'll only be 200,000. That'll be okay by me. I think that's still a quite good party. And there was Raul Castro. He was on the stage, but he's a bit old now. He didn't say anything, but that was exciting. And you go there and you learn about kind of the projects that they're doing, and about the effects of the blockade. The main thing they're trying to push is go home and try and fight the blockade. And the blockade has been there since the Cuban Missile Crisis. It stops people trading with Cuba. It stops Cuban goods leaving Cuba. And it's something if a boat has been to Cuba, a big shipping container, if it's been to Cuba, it can't go to the US for 180 days. And if you think that's the part of the world where you'd make the most money in that part of the world, so why would you go? And these effects meant stuff like no one would sell them the COVID vaccine. They had to make their own. They made five of their own. People wouldn't sell them ventilators. They had to build their own ventilators. And it means all their technology is kind of these kind of ramshackle together bits of tech, very well made, but where we would just use Windows and everything would plug in, they would have to kind of work all these workarounds. Everything's working on workarounds. So we visited a hospital. I think the hospitals and the healthcare is the thing they use as the example of, if we had unlimited resources, everything would be like this. But for now, this is the most important thing, is healthcare, education. And the hospital, it was incredible. I mean, we're in a place where they're literally having to reuse rubber gloves. They have to wash rubber gloves, which, I had a friend who went with us who didn't bring rubber gloves, because she's like, well, that's so basic. Obviously, they'll have them. And then we saw them, hanging them up. And yet, the actual outcomes of their healthcare are amazing, partly because it's very on preventative medicine. They were telling us that, I mean, there's a doctor in every community. The doctor does house calls to see, like, what could be the causes of these diseases, the sort of social causes. They're something else, they called them vector inspectors, which is a good word. And, you know, that meant that, like, if there's an outbreak somewhere, they will send someone in to find out why is that happening. You know, they've got rid of malaria. There, it was like the first country in 1997, first country to stop mother-to-baby HIV transmission. They've got a vaccine for lung cancer. I mean, I don't think it stops you getting it, but I think it massively stops the pace of growth. Things like that. They've got this amazing healthcare system by, like, this focus on, yeah, catching it as early as possible, but being willing to go the distance to treat people. And that was, yeah, their kind of, that's their big example of how things could be if we had unlimited resources. We'll put it all into this. The education as well is just, like, is incredible. Like, free university education up and through PhDs. And one of the things they have an issue with are people sort of leaving at the moment. Like, they train you up to be a doctor, and then you could go to America and make a lot more money. But they don't they won't stop you. They for them, the education is because, like, people should be educated. Yeah. And if you choose to leave, you obviously weren't the right person for the country, was their kind of logic. It was really fascinating to see someone with way more limited resources in the UK doing incredible things with what they had, whereas we have almost unlimited resources and we choose to do almost nothing.
Yeah, squandering.
Yeah.
Fascinating, anyway. Easy to visit?
So, yeah, it's kind of interesting. For British people, it's relatively easy to visit. I think, like, the Caribbean is a good place for communism, because as it's communist, there's quite a lot of paperwork. But as it's the Caribbean, they're not that fussed about it. Like, you have to do it all there, and then you get there, and there's just everyone's sort of like, brief look at it.
It's a sort of, I suppose, Hispanic type thing as well. Catholic, even, you know, that was, whole part of the world. Southern Europe doesn't seem to be quite, and certainly South America is like, okay. Unless they can get a bribe out of it, maybe.
And there is, obviously, it's not a country that is completely lacking in corruption, but I do think the fact that you could, the people who don't like it can leave, that actually means if you were choosing to be there, you're there because you support the project, right? So actually that kind of creates a very different dynamic to some of the things we saw in sort of ex-Soviet countries. You can go pretty easily. You know, you have to expect that, like, maybe they won't have ice cream when you're there. Maybe there'll be...
Did you get a chance to let your hair down much, will you?
So, because you're sort of on this kind of... We're guests of the state, so they kept us very busy, but they did also give us £1 mojitos on the camp. So we managed to get some good solid international solidarity drinking done and you could go into Havana. You could get a taxi, it was about 40 minutes. And so we had a night or two out in Havana. And Havana is a great night out. I mean, it is somewhere, and I think this is really important, is, like, we talk about, like, economic warfare, and we talk about the way that, like, these blockades and the way that, they're putting them on Russia at the moment.
Sanctions
are used. And in Cuba, you can really see the way that this is warfare. Like, there are buildings that are collapsing because over the decades, they've not managed to bring in the resources to sort of fix them. Like, it looks like bombs have been dropped in a place where bombs have not been dropped because of the way that it's been economically strangled. Like, and it's got worse as of late. It was sort of dropped under Obama quite a lot. Americans could go there much more easily. And to be fair, the Americans who were there were... I mean, annoying,
it's almost like the converse of Bristol. You've got all this money going into construction here and nowhere near enough into healthcare.
Yeah.
It sounds like they've got the priorities right, actually.
Yes, it's your right to food, education, housing and health. Like, those are the key foundations of any functioning society. And they were really proud of what they could do with what little they had. You know, it's fascinating. We talked about the allotments earlier, and Bristol is this place of, like, a permaculture haven. The real haven of permaculture is Cuba, but it is done in a real, instead of all this sort of slightly sort of weird hippie way, it's like, no, we're going to do this. Like, I read a quote from Raul Castro being like, we're going to have raised beds everywhere because one day we might have a guerrilla war against America. And we want to make sure there is food available that we can just grab at any moment. So therefore we should be growing food in these raised beds everywhere. But, like, you know, everything there is organic, everything there is, like, and they're trying to work with the climate. Like, one of the things that happened quite soon after the revolution, we sort of learned while reading on my way there, was they started digging loads of, like, ponds and lakes and things, because the environment had been so destroyed by 500 years of just growing just sugar.
Yeah.
as a cash crop.
United that, fruit. And
yeah.
People.
That the actual, like, biosphere was hugely degraded. And it's something, and it's sort of interesting seeing that kind of, what here would be a kind of a liberal, sort of apolitical approach, very much tied to the politics of the place. It's the only country in the world, I think, that's got more forest now than it did in 1960. Like, it's this sort of belief in making the environment somewhere that is habitable and livable for the people who live there.
And in a way, this is what, I mean, I'd written this thing on rewilding and this week, and it seems like industrial agriculture since, well, between the wars, but particularly after World War II, has been destroying our countryside. You know, this mass use of pesticides and fertilizers. Doesn't sound like in Cuba, they're basically still doing doing things the way that we used to do maybe 100 years ago without the need for these sorts of, you know, expensive.
Well, it's not even
imports.
Still doing it. They've had to go back to, they were doing some of the biggest, like, there was huge farms in Cuba in the 1950s. Like, it was all the cities were owned by basically the American mafia and using them for drugs and prostitution, and all the farms were owned by these giant corporations that were just destroying the landscape. They've had to go back to these different ways of approaching the environment. Rewilding is a fascinating example, because I read that book, The Book of Rewilding, and in that it's sort of, you know, written by a woman who owns a farm, and she's talking about these huge changes, like, oh, we'll just move all these roads 100 meters to the right, and we'll completely restructure the economy. And you go, well, who's going to restructure the economy? Yeah. And Cuba does present one answer.
This is a very bureaucratic thing.
Yes.
Rewilding. I mean, what they're trying to do, for example, down in the Bristol Channel, is because the power station, the new nuclear power station, is killing loads of fish, they've decided they're going to get a bit of the Somerset Levels and try and dig it out so that the fish can live there. The only thing is there'll be fresh water. And I mean, it's just like this is a bureaucracy which is descending from the top. Anyway, fascinating stuff. Maybe we should do the show from Cuba.
Oh, that would be nice.
At some point. Yeah, that would be rather nice. Anyway, Joe, you've got a book you wanted to plug.
Yes, there's a book coming out in September called Our City, which is a collection of essays written by people who've sort of had various campaigns or sort of issues in Bristol, particularly related to the mayoral system that we had. It's been collected by a woman called Suzanne Audrey. And I've written a chapter on a controversial planning issue in the old city of Bristol.
The one that
I talked to you quite at length.
Your book, in fact.
Yeah, yeah. So I've written a much shorter thing for this book, but I think it'll be very interesting. And there's a book launch at Waterstones on Union Street in Bristol on the 26th of September. Come along if you can.
And Isaac, you're now doing a podcast.
Yes.
Weekly?
Fortnightly, to start with. It's with the Bristol Cable. It's called People Just Do Something. The idea is it's kind of interviewing either kind of, the first one was Grace Blakely, and then the rest of them kind of activists, and kind of trying to kind of make it easy for people to get involved in sort of changing society around them, giving them like the tools or the kind of ideas, or, like, you know, the step-by-steps of campaigns. The episode's coming out next Monday, and we spoke to Faduma, who was the Acorn rep in Barton House, and sort of going through with her exactly, like, how did she become an activist? How did she get involved in the campaign? And it was by living there. And, like, the step-by-step of, like, how in Barton House did they organise to sort of fight the council and make themselves heard. Because I think, you know, so much of the story of Barton House was like, oh, look at these people, isn't it sad? And like,
well, what happened is the council shut it, didn't they? Because
yes.
They thought it wasn't safe and moved everyone into the Holiday Inn.
And then ignored them when they were telling them their conditions were horrible. Faduma told us a great story where basically the hotel wouldn't change her mattress, which was filthy when she got there. So she just drags it into the foyer of the hotel. And then she gets other people to drag their mattresses into the foyer of the hotel. And with all these filthy mattresses in the foyer of the hotel, suddenly the hotel goes from saying, well, we couldn't possibly change it, to getting these things changed very quickly. And that kind of realization of this sort of power of being, you know, collective and speaking collectively and working together and to make themselves heard by a council who was, you know, is willfully trying to ignore them and then later trying to, you know, besmirch them and do them down in the press, that how they went about doing that, rather than just the story of like, you know, showing that people who are involved in these campaigns are active and are thinking these things through and know what they're doing when they're leveraging power is kind of is the aim. So that's the that's the elevator pitch. I think it's good. You can find it where all good podcasts are found, and you should subscribe. And
well, no, you won't find it on Radio 4 All.
Not yet.
Where you could maybe at some point in the future. Website for that?
If you just search "People Just Do Something," there's a bit of the cable website, or just search on Spotify. "People Just Do Something."
And Joe, you've got your own site as well, I think, haven't you? Blog.
Yep.
Substack.
Website joe-banks.com.
Okay. Thanks very much, both of you, for joining us. We'll be hearing in a minute from Roland Dye from Bristol Palestine Solidarity. But by way of introduction to that, I've got a piece here, which is a clip from Roger Cook, investigative journalist, The Cook Report, which looks at whether or not there is weapons-grade plutonium and possibly even former Russian nuclear weapons circulating out there, as there seemed to be back in 1993, on the black market.
We're in Red Square and on our way to a secret meeting to buy plutonium to make a nuclear bomb. If the Cook Report can make a nuclear bomb in a briefcase, why can't terrorists do the same?
What price would the pure plutonium be?
The afternoon plane from the east brings in a smuggler in nuclear materials. He's a former member of the East German Secret Service, now a dealer in rare metals, keen to prove he can supply illegal nuclear materials. In a deserted car park, he's about to make a prearranged drop. It's a sample of highly enriched uranium. This is the nuclear black market at work. Here we are, the apocryphal bomb on your kitchen table.
That's realistic. In fact, very realistic.
The World Trade Center, New York, scene of the worst terrorist incident so far this year. A conventional car bomb was detonated in the basement of the world's tallest office block. But what if the terrorist responsible had used a nuclear weapon?
If this were at the World Trade Center, we would have skyscrapers with floors collapsing in on themselves. We would have heat close to the temperature of the surface of the sun. People would vaporize close in within a quarter to a half mile or so. And we are talking about one of the most densely populated areas of Manhattan.
He talked of tens of thousands of deaths, some immediate and many more in the future.
There will be tens, millions of particles of radioactive plutonium. And that is one of the most lethal and toxic materials known to man. A microgram, a speck, if inhaled, is lethal.
That day at Hiroshima, 80,000 died. In the 50 years since, the superpowers have tried to keep the nuclear threat under lock and key.
The President of the United States and the General Secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
But then the Cold War ended, and with it, the iron grip of communism. Capitalism, Russian style, now means that almost anything goes, including dangerous nuclear materials.
The system is so corrupt and so collapsed
What I suggest you do is actually go there with a fistful of dollars and see what you can purchase.
So that's Roger Cook there from 1993, from one of the all-time great Roger Cook programmes. He did a few around that time, just before he got closed down by Rupert Murdoch on the News of the World, who did a hatchet job on him. Central Television then pulled the programme, and then it never got actually restored, even though it was proved to be a whole load of lies that Murdoch had put out about Cook. But that one was called Dirty Bomb, features John Large, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page, as I've done a few months before as well, at thisweek.org.uk. And I'm joined in the studio here by Roland Dye, who's one of the coordinators for Bristol's Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Hi, Roland.
Hi there.
Now, I know you've got also your background. We spoke to you at the CND thing the other week about nuclear physics. So before we get into this one, I mean, I've just been moaning about, Keir Starmer's talking about our energy now, including nuclear, being clean energy.
Ha, well, that's a lie. Let's jump straight to the answer to that. All the fuel rods that have ever been used in reactors since the 1950s are piling up in Sellafield like a giant dustbin and will need to be somehow managed and kept safe. The latest estimate of the cost for that is, sharp intake of breath, £250 billion, and that's even before they start the job.
So there's 250 billion.
Even if the technology actually works, because nobody around the world has actually done it yet. So that's got a carbon footprint, and it's got a colossal financial cost, and that will be borne by future generations. So no way are the current nuclear power stations of whatever technology so-called clean or zero carbon. It's a lie.
Right. Okay. So, Martin, maybe I'll turn to you to ask about Cook and this idea that there may be. I mean, we keep hearing we're getting closer and closer to a potential nuclear confrontation. Everyone talks about Ukraine and Russia as a possible one. The Russians rather wittily saying, well, we're not going to bother bombing a nuclear bomb on Britain because it's destroying itself on its own without us bothering. But what do you make of this idea that there may be these rogue nukes out there? I think Roland has mentioned to me in the past about South Africa developing its nuclear program, and then once black majority rule, suddenly these nukes have disappeared, and one does wonder where they went.
Well, as you know, Tony, there's a story there about South Africa's nuclear warheads, which were transferred to Britain to be destroyed, supposedly, but via a MI6 front company called Astra Holdings, which was a subsidiary of Astra Fireworks, which people may remember who were of a certain age. And of course, these three warheads, David Kelly, David Cameron, and Sir, what's his name?
Kenneth Warren?
Kenneth Warren, that's right. Sir Kenneth Warren was a Tory party's chief fundraiser. They went down to do this deal in the early 90s, and the Tory party itself got £17 million from the deal, and various other people were paid off. But the Breidenkamp and Reutenbach, who were based up in Kilmersdown, double-crossed the people that they were selling the three nuclear warheads to, and those nuclear warheads then went out to be, you know, sold onto the black market somewhere, possibly in North Korea. Who knows?
That's South Africa. Roger Cook is talking about this is weapons grade plutonium is being offered, SS-20 entire weapon systems on the black market in 1993. It sounds like that with the early 90s might have been a bit of a period where the global eye was off the ball, so to speak.
Well, in the 1990s, early 90s, the Russian economy and society was being destroyed by the Gaidar plan, which had been, you know, put in place by people like Jeffrey Sachs and others. And, you know, the Russian, you know, often you got military people, for example, hadn't been paid their salaries for months. And, of course, in those circumstances, people do start to sell things off. One of the things that was happening in that period is virtually every bit of metal that was being totted out. So people were totting out railway lines, all sorts of things, vital infrastructure, electricity pylons, and the whole country. And this, because of Ukraine and Russia, were still the same. You know, they'd split, but they were still part of the same setup.
I can remember seeing a film.
It was a criminalized, totally criminalized situation.
Russians going around with car tyres, old car tyres that had a little slice cut out of them, and then they pile up all these car tyres at the bottom of an electricity pylon on the main, one of the main struts of it, set fire to the lot, and it gets so hot, this rubber, as it's burning, that it just buckles the metal and the whole pylon comes down, and they were then sawing these things up for scrap.
Yes, and it was all being exported through the Baltic states, because they used to go to the Baltic states quite a lot, and they became some of the biggest exporters of metals in the world, even though they've got no metal at all. There's no iron ore, there's no real steel industry or anything, but of course what they were doing was totting out the former Soviet Union and selling it onto the international market via the Baltic states. And there's quite a lot of criminal gangs involved in all of this. And of course, in those circumstances, trying to buy up nuclear material would be, that's the sort of thing that might be possible. But, that's then, and this is now. Modern Russia is much better organised than that.
You're kind of making the point as well, Martin, there, that the Russian people now see Putin as rather a saviour, because they could see the way things were going in the 90s, around about 2000. It looked as if the whole country was being parasitised. Everything was being just stripped from it, stuff that people have worked for decades for.
Well, that's right. I mean, in 1998, when the Russians defaulted on their foreign debt, bringing down long-term capital management, which was the sort of, poster child of digital capitalism of the era, and they had to be bailed out by the US government. The situation in Russia seemed as if, under the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, seemed to be completely out of control. The whole place was spiralling towards civil war, not dissimilar to Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was the first of the Eastern countries to fall into chaos because they were most exposed to Western influence. The Russians were the last ones to fall into that, but their situation was particularly dire. But what Putin did is what they call the Siloviki, who were basically the old intelligence military infrastructure. They kind of took control of the runaway car, and they've reorganized everything, and they've rebuilt. I mean, people's living standards today are far, far better than they were in the 90s. And of course, in the 90s. Although they had a very low life expectancy, it dropped. Life expectancy actually dropped. So millions of people in Russia during this period died unnecessarily because of austerity policies, which with hindsight were totally idiotic. And Jeffrey Sachs himself these days says, I've put my hand up, we were wrong about that. We got it wrong. I presume that if they carried out a crash privatisation programme, that the West would come up with loads of money to fund it. And, of course, they didn't do anything.
I'm getting deja vu here, because this happens all the time. I mean, for example, in Zimbabwe, they had this agreement, apparently, that Kissinger cut with the Zimbabweans that would allow for a peaceful transition. And then after everyone had signed the agreement, it became clear about a year, 18 months later, that all of these promises of money were just not going to be there. And so the whole thing was just a way of kicking the can down the road. Anyway, look, Roland, let's go back to talking, I think, a little bit about nuclear power and nuclear energy. Because when I spoke to you the other week, you were saying that you think there is this very close connection between the two. People who are professionals in one industry, maybe trained up in power, but then get jobs in the nuclear weapons world.
Oh, yes, this has been well studied and published. But we wouldn't be getting these new power stations around our country if it wasn't that Britain needed to keep up the technology to maintain its nuclear weapons system, which is called Trident. It's submarine-based intercontinental ballistic missiles. They need big engineering. They need a technical skilled workforce, of which I'm a deserter, of course. They need a huge logistics network as well. I mean, you look at Germany, they've been turning off their nuclear power stations and not building any more. They don't possess their own nuclear weapons. So you can see the link there. And this has been published, I remember a few years ago, an article in The Guardian, electricity consumers to fund nuclear weapons through their bills and that sort of thing. Just Google that. And going back to nuclear weapons themselves, I mean, it's dangerous incredibly risky in all respects. So I brought along this favourite book of mine by Eric Schlosser called Command and Control, and he gives, it's American, a complete history of all the near misses, which we never hear about.
Yeah, I remember reading a book in the 90s, The Limits to Safety, which is a similar look at the various near misses, like such as these bombers being sent off to bomb Russia because they believed that a Russian infantry had broken into their airbase in America, and it turned out that it actually was a bear that had broken into the airbase through
the
fence.
At the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
That's right, where they were on very high alert, you see. Yeah.
Flocks of geese, rising moons, you know, can trigger these systems. None of it is safe. And he concentrates on the Damascus incident, which is the 1980s. There were these underground silos with enormous rockets fueled up, ready to go. On the top is a device, the explosive power of several times all munitions used on all fronts during the Second World War. And these have to be serviced and worked on, so there's technicians sort of on ladders doing things, unscrewing inspection covers and such like. And one day they drop the spanner and it falls down the crack between their scaffolding and the side of the missile. Drops down 10 stories deep, ricochets off something, punctures the fuel tank. There's nothing in their manual that tells them how to deal with a fuel tank that's spewing its fuel out into the bottom of the silo. Several days go past. Do they inform the local sheriff? The president's due to make a speech at some local city a few dozens of miles away and such like. Eventually the whole thing explodes, goes up like a Roman candle, and this thing about the size of a small car tumbles through the air and comes down, lands in the mud, and didn't explode. It was that near. And in America, they made actual soap opera movies about this, but we've never heard of it. And you notice we never hear about anything. Like, I challenge your listeners to know where Britain's nuclear bomb factory is. If you ever travelled along the M4 to London, just after you pass Reading Services, look to your right. You can see a cluster of low buildings and lightning conductors. That's Britain's nuclear bomb factory. It's been in special measures from the Health and Safety Executive on safety for a number of years. I mean, it's a nuclear bomb factory. What could possibly go wrong? And then how do they get the warheads up to Scotland and back?
On the train, I imagine. Every month
or so. Public roads, long military convoys. The most likely worst case scenario is that one of those vehicles collides with, say, a fuel tanker and bursts into flames. Probably wouldn't be a nuclear explosion, but the explosives which compact the plutonium would catch fire. So you'd have a dirty bomb, a plutonium fire, which could spread for hundreds of miles. And I've got a quote.
So a dirty bomb basically means that you've got a really nasty toxic fallout over a large area. So this isn't the nuclear bomb actually going bang with a mushroom cloud.
No, but
it does go bang. It does go bang, but what's spewed out is lots and lots of rather, well, extremely toxic. I imagine it's mostly just either uranium, plutonium or something like that.
Well, the Ministry of Defence says the consequences of such an incident are likely to be considerable loss of life, severe disruption to both the British people's way of life and the UK's ability to function as a sovereign state. In other words, there's no clean-up operation that could deal with such an incident. This is happening every 6 weeks.
Well, so what John Large is talking about in that documentary as this dirty bomb which they managed to smuggle onto a plane is the idea that this could be actually a deliberate bomb, which is a dirty bomb, not an accident or whatever. So that this could be a deliberate kind of terrorist attack by some group to really just deny the use of a whole area. Now, I look at things like Afghanistan, I look at things like Gaza, I look at things like Libya. This mentality is out there, isn't it, Martin? The idea that you're just going to deny a whole massive area to your so-called enemy.
Well, I think that the possibility of using dirty bombs, if you remember, the US said the main problem with a dirty bomb is it's going to cause panic because, you know, in actual fact, it is dangerous and unpleasant, but it's the real danger is it's actually going to cause panic, and that's why we've got to protect against dirty bombs. I don't think you can. I mean, you see one of the Israeli ministers saying, can we nuke Gaza? I don't think you can, if you think about it. Nuclear weapons are only really usable if you're firing at something quite a long way away from you. If you're firing at somebody close to you, I mean, what, for example, if somebody used a tactical nuclear weapon in the Ukraine, well, it would soon blow back all over yourself.
Well, look, hang on.
Same with India and Pakistan. If there was a nuclear exchange, even if one side managed to do it, the other side would still be destroyed anyway.
To talk about this Kursk nuclear plant, which and Zaporizhia nuclear plant in Roland in Ukraine and the Kursk one in Russia, the objective, it seems, of this force which was sent in by the Ukrainians into Russia seems to have been to take over this Russian nuclear plant, maybe with the object of threatening to do something like this, to deliberately destroy it, or at least to hold it. So this is almost becoming real before our eyes.
Well, yes, I understand that though Hinkley C won't have it, the subsequent ones, if they, God forbid, actually carry on building them, will have a sort of defensive wall around the outside, a bit like a medieval city.
Well, there's this thing called the containment, isn't there? There's the containment.
On the edge. This would be on the perimeter. So you could get all your soldiers there defending this sort of medieval city. It's nonsense, of course. You can't not do that. It's impossible. But, of course, these things are targets. And as we saw with Chernobyl, which was really quite a modest-sized nuclear power station, which polluted, well, the pollution came as far as this country. Remember the sheep in Wales that couldn't be sold because they were radioactive? You can't have a bonfire of a nuclear power station spreading over all of Europe and Russia without having terrible consequences.
What about this whole idea of you've got these declared nuclear powers and then you've got some like Israel that will say nothing?
Like Israel that refuses to confirm or deny that it has nuclear weapons. It's a horribly dangerous situation, yeah.
The Iranians. I mean, surely, if there's been this, this is always my point. If there has been this period in the 1990s, maybe even at other points in history, where this nuclear material has been available on the black market, Martin. You know, we surely all sorts of nations may secretly have it. Of course, they have the ability to keep this stuff stumm, don't they?
Well, I mean, we worrying about sort of rogue nukes in the hands of goodness knows who. I mean, we can worry about that. But, of course, we've got plenty of, you know, officially held nukes by various countries. Japan could easily become a nuclear power very quickly, and they may be encouraged to do so by the Americans. We'll have to see.
Well, the North Koreans have made absolutely clear that their wish to have nuclear weapons is based on the fact that they don't want the Americans to invade them, and they want to be able to hit States. They're not going to do it unless the Americans try it. But this is almost becoming a reality, isn't it? The United States seems to think that they can invade pretty much any country that they want to around the world on some sort of flimsy excuse, but they haven't actually taken on these nuclear states like North Korea.
Well, that's why the North Koreans developed nuclear weapons, because they could see what happened to Gaddafi, who got rid of his own weapons programs, and of course, as soon as he disarmed, they got rid. They went for it. And people out there in the world at large do not trust the West's good officers. You know, they just don't. You know, we're not relying on your good will.
I mean, is this
based on sound experience as well? I mean, I'm shocked at how we were lied to. I mean, okay, I did physics at university, and we were reassured that there was a clear division between civil and military nuclear technology. So, like this country claimed, it was building civil nuclear power stations to make electricity so cheap they won't bother to meter it. Do you remember that lie, that propaganda lie? And now you just have to go onto Wikipedia and it will tell you that the first generation of nuclear power stations called Magnox were actually optimized for the production of plutonium, which would be for the British bombs. Now, my professors, who I believe were probably honest people, they wanted to believe that technically it was completely impossible. There was a difference between the two. And that turned out to be a lie. So any country that had a nuclear power station would be able to make its own plutonium and produce a bomb quite rapidly.
Okay, so what about Iran?
I'm sure they're on the road.
They could probably do it. And that's exactly how the Indians developed their nuclear bomb, through using civil nuclear technology from Canada.
And Israel, yes, because they've got a nuclear power station. Where else would the plutonium and the technology come from?
So what were you doing when you had this sort of moment of thinking to yourself, I've had enough of this industry?
Oh, my epiphanal moment. I mean, I grew up in Bristol. I was a swot at school. My physics teacher told me I was good at physics, and why don't I consider doing that at university? I mean, you know, fair enough. You know, they were pushing the best of them. I mean, looking back now, the year I was born, 1952, a long time ago, I discovered that, to me, three significant things happened. The Queen came to the throne. Don't get me started on British Empire. Britain exploded its first nuclear bomb in Australia, and Britain was plotting a coup against the democratically elected government of Iran, which is an interesting story in itself. So you can see that the year I was born, somebody in high office was thinking, we need more boffins. We need more people studying physics. So they expanded the universities, they funded them, the courses expanded, they built the laboratories. So by the time I was 18, they were there, an offer went to do physics. And I swallowed it all. You know, that's education. You believe that, you know, what they're telling you is the whole story. And I didn't work in nuclear power, and I didn't work in bomb production. I went for something that I still think is good for humanity. It's called nuclear medicine. It's a way of imaging patients in hospitals that talks about function rather than structure. And I was working as a scientist in that department. And I came home one day and switched on the television, which is where you got your news from in those days. And those silly people in Greenpeace were causing trouble. They were going down trying to put a bung in the end of the pipeline coming out of Sellafield. Very reckless, very foolish. I mean, you can trust the establishment. It's all perfectly clean. It was all looked after. That's what they taught us on our courses. And then they had a high-power inflatable speedboat, and they were following these boats, or this boat that was going out and rolling barrels of radioactive waste into the Atlantic. Interesting, those barrels were being loaded onto the ships up at Sharpness, not far north of Bristol. Anyway, I watched this on the news, and I just thought, well, Greenpeace just don't understand the science. It's all well looked after by other people, a bit like me, good, honest, sincere people. They must know what they're doing. Greenpeace are being reckless troublemakers. And then the news story cut, and it showed a picture of a nuclear medicine department that I recognised. It was a big one in London. And it said the waste in those barrels was coming from hospital departments like mine. And at which moment, I knew that that was a total lie. Now, this probably seems very naive. I didn't realise then that the media, the television, told lies. And it's changed my life. So that was my epiphanal moment.
Mm. You're also involved in the Palestine Solidarity campaign here in Bristol, and I'd just like to ask you why it was you felt, and at what point you felt that, because I mean, this is obviously part of the peace movement. We've got an attempt to do some very strange things right now, which is to accuse people who support Hamas of being supporting a proscribed terrorist organisation. So if you were stood in front of the judge who was accusing you of some of what you were saying implying support for Hamas, what would you say to them?
I think the Palestine movement is on the side of humanity and life and against injustice. But to pick up the story that I was brainwashed, I think as a sort of 12-year-old probably, I was taken down to the Odeon in Broadmead, when it was the cinema there, and there was this very stirring, emotional film called Exodus, and I can still remember the soundtrack, the stirring music, and the storyline. And I didn't understand in the early 2000s, friends of mine who were going to this place called Palestine. I mean, why are you getting mixed up in all that sort of stuff for? I mean, I was very prejudiced against what was going on. I didn't understand it. And yet they were good friends, and they came back and they told me stories that I just couldn't make sense of it. So I began to look at it myself. And that's why, for me, 2005, I went over with an olive harvest group the company called Zaytoun, who import Palestinian olive oil into this country, a very good fair trade product. And you don't need to be an expert, you don't need to be a researcher or a journalist or anything. Within 24 hours of arriving in the West Bank, you have seen everything. You've seen the wall, you've seen the army of occupation, you've seen the checkpoints, you've seen the settlement built on the tops of the hills, you've seen the apartheid road network. It's jaw-dropping, and it's obvious. And I had a sort of angry little saying, the BBC have to stand on their heads to not show people what's happening in Palestine, in the West. That's the West Bank, as opposed to Gaza. And I took with me a pocket-sized video camera, the technology of the time. And because I'd been a teacher, I was determined to somehow, you know, tell the story. So I made these eyewitness documentaries about my trips to Palestine. And, you know, one of them's on YouTube, and I must get the rest uploaded because they've stood the test of time. It's just an ordinary person from Bristol. I'm not an expert. I'm travelling around, and it's OMG stuff. And the Palestinians will all tell you their stories of injustice and how they get their homes raided in the middle of the night. It happened in the village that we were in. We heard loud bangs. Oh, that's the military throwing sound grenades around, and they raid people's houses. They take their, usually it's their teenage lads away, and beat them or lock them up and on trump charges and put them into prison. This is normal for a Palestinian life. It's repressive, it's unjust, it's absolutely truly shocking. So it changed my life.
Well, Martin, there's been a whole spate of arrests, actually, with people like Craig Murray being arrested at the airport. We had Richard Medhurst last week. This week, a couple more arrests, including Sarah Wilkinson. But you know, the idea is that somehow people are criminals because they're supporting Hamas, which is a proscribed group. One of the things I find difficult to just untangle from all of this is that why does... You know, Israel is fighting Palestine. Why is Israel's army called the Israeli Defense Force, and it's referred to as an army, whereas the Palestinians' army is called a terrorist?
Well, as you know, there's one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter and all the rest of it. I find it quite extraordinary, because from the very beginning, they've been saying that it's legitimate for the Israelis to try to eliminate Hamas, and that was the position of Rishi Sunak, and it seems to be the position of Keir Starmer. Now, Hamas won the last Palestinian election in 2006. They overall won because they consisted in what they'd been saying. They were saying that we're not necessarily going to recognise the state of Israel, and of course the Israelis go mental and say, well, you've got to recognise, otherwise you're not serious. There's no reason why you should before you've done a deal.
Can we just get back to this point of why are the Palestinians not allowed to have an army?
Well, I'm just pointing out that in actual fact they are an elected government, they have got an army, it's fighting the Israeli army, and they're justified, as we've seen, the International Court of Justice has ruled the occupation of Palestine to be illegal. Now, if it's an illegal occupation in international law, Palestinian armed forces are entitled to fight. They are. Under international law. They're not entitled to just kidnap anybody at random, and that's an issue. And that will probably have to be addressed. But of course, the Israelis are holding thousands and thousands of Palestinian prisoners. And then nobody even raises that. And of course, the Israeli Defense Forces are, in fact, the latest manifestation of the Irgun, the Haganah, and the Lehi. Basically terrorist organisations that used to kill British soldiers and were proscribed at the time. So the Likud party is an extremist party. I think we shouldn't talk to them at all. They're terrorists. They're terrorists. They created a state through terrorism. We're not going to talk to them at all. Or we say, well, we are going to talk to Likud, and we're also going to talk to Hamas. Why not? They're the elected people.
And if anybody's confused by all this, it's always worth mentioning that the Zionists did have a plan to assassinate Winston Churchill in 1946. It was all part of their plan.
That's right. Well, they also wanted to assassinate Ernie Bevin, who was the Foreign Secretary, and they did assassinate Lord Moyne, who was the British representative. And, of course, the Israelis who carried out those terrorist attacks were not punished. They were rewarded by being given a state. Now, this is the way the world works, yeah? you know, Jomo Kenyatta becomes president of Kenya after a massive war with the British, which he didn't directly participate in. You know, this is normal stuff. And you can't eliminate Hamas. And, of course, they haven't eliminated it. All opinion polls seem to show that their support within the population has rocketed as a result of everything that's happened.
And if there's anybody who hasn't unravelled all this history, I was going to say complex, but really it's very straightforward, you've just got to go back to 1948. The Palestinians call it the Nakba, the catastrophe, when they were ethnically cleansed from their homes and cities and villages, and most of them were deliberately destroyed to drive them out of the country. This is why Palestinians are the single largest refugee population in the world, because they were driven out of the majority of their country in 1948. Look it up.
Now, I remember listening, as I said last week, in the around about 1980, the first Gulf War, the BBC did an excellent job of taking people through the history. Various correspondents from, I think many of them were based at Memo, which was in Beirut, Middle East Media Office, I think they called it. And there was a really, you know, very good historic coverage of why the first Gulf, you know, all the things that had led up to the first Gulf War. Nowadays, very, very little, much less, in fact, even when Jeremy Bowen was speaking, I think it was yesterday on the PM programme, you see Evan Davis thinking to himself, oh gosh, this is a little bit anti-Israel. And so when it finishes, he says he has a little caveat, and we will later in the programme be having somebody who's very pro-Israel to counter this. Now hang on, this is the BBC just telling you what's going on, and that is considered to be pro-Palestinian, and that the editorial of the BBC think that they've got to have a pro-Israeli to balance it up. I'm afraid that's just not the case. Bowen is just telling you, as it is, what's going on. What about this group Palestine Action? Because they're similar aims, that is to say the freedom for the Palestinian people, Roland, but they take a different approach, don't they? You're doing things like street activities and demos and rallies and things.
Well, Palestine Action is a different group, and it's a non-violent direct action group, and people need to know that in the north of Bristol there's one of the largest concentrations of arms companies in Western Europe, and some of that includes an Israeli arms company called Elbit. They have an administrative office in Aztec West, which is up in Patchway, right up the very top of Gloucester Road before you get to the motorway. And a year ago, they opened a £35 million manufacturing facility sort of at the end of the Filton runway on the right-hand side of Gloucester Road as you go up in a sort of new development up there. And it looks pretty formidable. Now, I'm also in a group called Bristol Palestine Alliance, and we've done three or four rallies up there, you know, peaceful, legit things with speakers and so on. And it's pretty formidable. I mean, I've looked at it and went, wow, that's quite a fortress. And it's got, you know, huge, great steel bollards sewn across the road that goes up to the factory, and security guards, and they put up extra fencing when they know that we're coming. It looks pretty impregnable. But the group Palestine Action, they have a website. You'll know that 3 years ago now, there was a very daring raid on the admin office at Aztec West. That was called the Elbit 7. Brave people smashed their way in with sledgehammers. Their signature is also lots of red paint, and they wear red boiler suits. So all the photographs are all very dramatic. And those people stood trial here in Bristol. And there's been rooftop occupations and lock-ons and that sort of thing. And you can find all this in the local media. But this recent raid on the factory in Filton certainly looked very dramatic. I mean, I don't understand how all this stuff works, but it was described as ram raiding. They had a large vehicle, a sort of prison transporter vehicle or something, presumably something pretty heavy, and managed to ram raid their way into the building. I mean, you get snatches of short videos, and suddenly they're inside with sledgehammers smashing up technology. Let's talk about Elbit for a moment, because listeners may remember that some months ago, three aid workers were mysteriously killed in Gaza. They were protecting food convoys that were going into Gaza because there's a food shortage, obviously. And their vehicles were probably deliberately targeted by a drone.
Oh, they were definitely deliberately targeted.
Well,
they.
I'm being neutral here.
Yeah, okay.
There was no mistaking it. Had clear markings.
There were three separate attacks on. First of all, which killed several people. As those people tried to escape, they were again attacked, and then there was another attack, as I remember it, along the road.
No, I didn't know that. I thought they were three separate vehicles. They would be travelling along a road. The Israelis would be notified, so they didn't hit them by accident. Yeah. They'd be very spread out, so if one was hit, the others would be so. All three were hit.
Yeah.
And that included somebody from Bristol, so somebody who lived in Southville. And, you know, that's sort of gone off with very little recognition that that Elbit drone possibly could have been powered by an engine which was made in this country up in the Midlands, because Elbit have a factory that makes the engines for drones up in the Midlands. And the government's refusing to say whether there was an export license for that technology. And this is truly shocking that Elbit kills Bristolians.
Well, the government is also helping the Israeli genocidalists in other ways. So, for example, Middle East Eye today has announced the UK police are charging co-founder of Palestine Action under the Terrorism Act. Richard Barnard is accused of expressing support for Hamas and has been charged with two counts of criminal damage. So the co-founder of Palestine Action has been charged with violating the Terrorism Act after a series of speeches in Manchester and Bradford. Richard Barnard stands accused of expressing an opinion that's supportive of a proscribed organisation contrary to Section 12 of the Terrorism Act 2000. Barnard is 41, will appear before Westminster Magistrates Court on 18th of September, where he also faces two charges of encouraging or intending to encourage criminal damage. Charges stem from an investigation by the Specialised Counter-Terrorism Policing North West Unit into a demonstration held on the 8th of October in Manchester after Hamas launched an attack on southern Israel. Police have accused Barnard of expressing an opinion and belief in support of a proscribed organisation, namely Hamas. Martin.
Well, I think this is definitely the direction of travel, isn't it? Because Richard Medhurst was stopped at the Heathrow Airport and accused similarly. I think that they only proscribed Hamas relatively recently. I mean, Hezbollah and Hamas were not proscribed. And, you know, it was okay to express support.
I mean, we're talking about 3 or 4 years ago?
Yeah, relatively recent. And, of course, it's just an administrative decision.
But why on earth is the Likud party not a proscribed organisation?
Well, exactly. That was the point I was making earlier. You could say, well, Likud is a terrorist organisation. If we're going to say you can't speak for Hamas, well, you can't speak for Likud.
Also, are these police acting, and the Department for Justice here, are they acting on behalf of the Israeli state?
Indirectly, yes. Britain is being lobbied by the Israelis to do something about these people who are protesting, and that's what they're doing. It'll be interesting to see what happens when this goes to court. In any case, just mentioning...
Surely idea is not even that they may not even get a conviction, but the idea is that the Palestine Action is out of action, as their boss is in jail.
Well, yes, well, it's harassment. And, you know, it is what it is. But, I mean, if you think back to the Troubles, the Provisional IRA was a proscribed organisation and you weren't supposed to speak on behalf of it, which is why you had Gerry Adams' voice dubbed and so forth, which, of course, they still had him on. Well, they had his voice dubbed.
Hang on. As far as I remember from the 1980s and the IRA campaign, people could still say that what they thought that what they were doing was right. They just couldn't put somebody on the news who was actually from the IRA.
Yes.
So the idea here is they're taking this one step further, saying nobody is allowed to say that the Palestinian army has a right to exist or should win.
Yes, I mean, and I think this has got to be challenged, because ultimately Hamas are part of the solution, if there is any solution. They've got to be negotiated
with. If there's any of their leaders haven't been assassinated, left.
Well, I mean, I think this is overreach by the executive in this country. They can prescribe any organisation. They can prescribe the Boy Scouts if they want to.
Do you really think Yvette Cooper's behind this?
Yvette Cooper is following
Home Secretary?
She's following the line that should be coming from Number 10, which will be coming from the Foreign Office, which will be coming from, ultimately, the Israelis and the Americans who tell us what to do.
And I think we've got to ask, why is it happening now? So we've had all these months of protests. The protest movement, hats off to all those people who get the coaches up to London or have been protesting here in Bristol and showing great determination and actually increasing in numbers and determination. Wonderful people. And, you know, you can see that the powers that be are thinking, this isn't going to go away. So now we're seeing the pushback that suddenly, out of the blue, they're using these new powers and detaining people. And it's a sign of their desperation. And there is this old saying, isn't there? First they ignore you. Well, they haven't been able to ignore it. And then they laugh at you. Well, they've tried various dirty tricks. And then they fight you. So we're entering into that third phase.
And then you win, yeah.
Well, hopefully, yeah, you will. If you maintain and you keep, and if people work together and support each other and stand up for what's right, and history shows that, you know, then you win.
Well, genocidalist evil people won't win, I can guarantee. Just this is not possible. In fact, if you chat with Palestinians, as we were doing recently in London, you just get the sense that they will absorb anything that's thrown at them. They will absorb and they will survive. And in fact, the more, Martin, this is quite true with Hamas, isn't it? The more the Israelis throw at them, particularly US bombs, weapons of all sorts, then actually the more support they get, not only from their own people, Hamas, but from the outside world. And I suppose that's what this is trying to put a lid on it desperately.
Yes, they are. I think at first, because you see that they've charged this guy for speaking the day after October the 7th. So they've left it all this time before they've decided to call it in. And of course, there's lots of questions about what happened on October the 7th, because they had plenty of warning. And they allowed it to happen so they could do what they
Anyway, Richard Barnard is this guy who's been arrested, was one of the people who started Palestine Action. Let's have a listen to him now talking about why direct action, he thinks, is the right way to do things.
I'm Richard Barnard, also a co-founder of Palestine Action. I've been involved in many direct action groups prior to Palestine Action, including Extinction Rebellion at the very beginning of it. And also prior to Palestine Action, I'd done actions against Elbit Systems, which again we'll go on to later, but in a kind of sporadic and small group way, never kind of getting the public imagination or bringing on lots of people and being very sort of insular. And that's sort of part of the reason I think behind why I think Palestine Action has been so successful, is because it looks out rather than looks in and brings in people from other movements. I think for me, really simple, it works. It's the only thing that ever has, yeah? All these other things move things so slowly, bureaucracies that we build up even within well-meaning and well-intentioned NGOs. Direct action is the only thing that actually gets the goods. So for us, it's a strategic choice. The other things, really, to be honest with you, they don't work. And therefore, that's why we chose direct action as being the crucial thing for us. I also think that we're aware of, you know, direct action has been used for many years, but we're also aware of the zeitgeist. What's going on in the world now? I've referenced Extinction Rebellion already. It's the right time for this thing, yeah, for this stepping up. This is what the world's like. More and more, especially young people, understand the futility and the pointlessness of the political class and the political systems. And those of us from a working class background also don't want to get into, and some of us through poor education just can't get into those ridiculous debates where we don't understand half the words. But what we can understand is the oppressed nature of the Palestinian people. And what we can also understand is that we can do something about it. And that shutting a factory by sacrificing our own bodies, our own liberty, is something very easy to understand and brings in people of all types. So we are after all types. Inclusivity is often said, well, it's not that inclusive because only certain type of people can do it. Now, I want to say in our movement, we have not designed it to be particularly inclusive, but, you know, we have, you know, prominent people of colour. We have more women than men, young women. We have people who are retired. We have disabled people. You know, if you wanted to give all those things, we've got them all in there because it's inclusive, because you don't need to have a university education to understand that this works. It's a simple process. That's an evil arms company doing evil stuff to the Palestinian people, and we're going to shut it by using our own bodies.
So that's Richard Barnard, who's been charged today. He was arrested with supporting a proscribed organisation. He said it's the only thing that works. I mean, whenever people say things like that, I just think of the IRA peace agreement, Martin, and the fact that it was direct action by the IRA in the City of London that, you know, through phony and telephone warnings. But I'm not saying that Palestine Action should be doing this, obviously. But the history is evidence that by destroying buildings in the City of London, like the Baltic Wharf, etc., and by phoning in warnings so that nobody, apart from some rather reckless cameraman who crossed the police line, is killed, that this actually forces the two negotiating partners together. At the moment, obviously, the Israelis quite clearly do not want, under Netanyahu, any kind of peace settlement. They want to just carry this war on.
Well, I think, you know, tactics are going to vary depending on circumstances and you know, where and when you're operating. There's a whole spectrum. I mean, you know, sometimes, you know, it shouldn't be writing off people protesting in large numbers in big demonstrations.
I don't think he's writing it off. He's saying it doesn't work.
Well, he can say
that if
he likes.
It's very good for morale. Maybe yeah. It does work to a certain extent.
I think he wouldn't be able to do what he does unless other people were doing other things. You know, all of these things are potentially legitimate. And, of course, it's important that people have a way of participating without having to take the risks that he's taking. I'm perfectly happy for him to do what he wants to do, but he can't, like, you know, not everybody can do that. And, you know, that goes all the way up to, you know, armed struggle, which is effectively what the Palestinians are carrying out. You know, the Hamas, El Qassam brigades, and the Palestine Islamic Jihad are fighting from their tunnels as we speak, and they're killing. They've killed lots of Israeli soldiers, and they destroyed lots of tanks. I mean, in many ways, the Israelis, by bombing Gaza to pieces, have created a perfect. You know, they've Stalingradized Gaza, and now their tanks can't move around because there are, you know, people popping up. I've seen videos of people popping up from the tunnels and just mining these tanks and blowing them up. And of course, also they've dropped loads and loads of explosives all over the place, which haven't exploded, and they're all being harvested by Hamas and taken into the tunnels and turned into weaponry, and they've not been beaten at all. The Israeli army has completely failed to subdue them. What we need is quick ceasefire.
Whoops, sorry about that. I thought she was going to actually be saying something. I'm trying to play something here by Sarah Wilkinson. Sarah is another journalist. She's very, very prolific on Twitter, etc., who's been also been arrested this week. She says thank you to Hussein Shafi, to Craig Murray and to George Galloway. He says, my mother was hurt, denied medication and bailed to never use a phone or a laptop. That's because her mother was also, it seems, arrested when she was arrested. Injuries and theft of property by what she describes as 16 balaclava-clad thugs that turned up at her house. And before we talk a bit about Sarah's arrest, let's have a listen to what Roger Waters, the Pink Floyd singer, songwriter, had to say about it when she was arrested this week.
So, 12 cops, the old Bill, come round to the house and arrest you. Sarah Wilkinson, I'm talking about now, they arrest you for standing up for human rights, campaigning against genocide. Okay, we know that these are policies that Keir Starmer doesn't agree with and Rishi Sunak didn't agree with, but you cannot get the old Bill to come round and arrest people who have hearts and minds and have made up their own mind what they think about foreign policy. This is wrong. If you allow this to stand, the arrest of Sarah Wilkinson and the persecution of my friend Craig Murray, among others, then you have absolutely accepted that England is now a fascist state. 1984 has arrived and is alive and well in the United Kingdom over my dead body.
So there's Roger Waters there with his thoughts on this arrest of Sarah Wilkinson. She, one of her last tweets, Roland, that she put out was a photograph of a UN aid agency UNRWA vehicle with all looks like about six or seven bullet holes in the windows of it. UN aid agency leave Gaza after Israelis shoot their vehicle 10 times. You can only see about 7 of the shots in the in that photograph, but Palestinians are shot at a million times, but they just have to endure it. She sent that on Thursday. It looks like possibly before, 6 in the morning, before she was arrested yesterday. So, although she's now been released, what do you make of these moves on people who are literally just posting facts about the results of an Israeli genocide on Twitter?
Well, it's absolutely outrageous. But as I was saying before, I suppose there comes a certain stage in a campaign when, you know, the state starts to push back. And this is exactly what it would look like. They would start trying to silence journalists and free-thinking people. You know, back to the saying, you know, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you. So we're at that stage. And going back to the discussion about Palestine action, I mean, I suddenly had a burst of inspiration to realise that a protest movement is like an ecosystem. You need different organisations, you need all of them, but they can all be different, but they all interlock in some way or another, a bit like an ecosystem. There might be some bug or somewhere that you don't know why it's there or what purpose it serves, and then there's some change in the weather or something like that, and it becomes important. They all fit together like a jigsaw puzzle, and it's not that some are right or some are wrong. As you were saying, the large marches inspire people, it gets people on the streets, it's a show of solidarity, and then also people meet and start to plan other things. And we've seen an evolution going on here in our own city. There's small groups beginning to think for themselves and organising independently, organising sort of dramatic action events. And this is excellent. And this is more people thinking for themselves and carrying out responsible actions of whatever type is people thinking for themselves. And that underlies the whole movement. And that's what's so important. And also, I've noticed that people are coming forward who perhaps have never thought about Palestine or what's happening in the Middle East before. It's a long way away. We've got a lot of preoccupations at home. And they say, I'm confused. I don't understand what's going on. Well, and then you get onto a discussion about how the media lies and distorts and its message. But they can see that something terrible is happening in Gaza. It is a genocide. And as many people have said, it's the first time in history that we've been able to watch a genocide unfolding month after month after month on our mobile devices, on our phones and such like. And people, if they're not, when they eventually break free of the propaganda, are seeing human beings treated in the most appalling way. This is beyond anything that we ever imagined could actually happen in this so-called civilized world. And they're drawing their own conclusions. And that's why, if anything, the movement is getting stronger. Obviously, things have slowed down a bit over the summer. I would think come the autumn, we're going to see a massive upsurge in protest because people have built up that head of steam. The intolerability of this ghastly situation inflicted on lovely people, anybody who's met a Palestinian, that, you know, you fall in love with them straight away. They're just so lovely. And nobody deserves it. I mean, the North American Indians didn't deserve what happened to them in North America. All the other people who have been ethnically cleansed in colonial history, you know, the Aborigines, what happened in Kenya, what happened in South Africa, and so on and so forth. And you know, suddenly, this is a way of making sense of history that the normal history books and the media don't explain.
Well, the interesting question for me is always why. And it's a question I don't hear enough asked by so-called journalists on the television, for example, which is just drilling into the questions of why. Because, I mean, it's basics, like, what's in it for us to be supporting this genocide? Of course, there's nothing in it for the British people, but there may be other interests. And I came across an interesting, I think it was sent in by one of our listeners. Thank you very much, if it was, whoever you are. It's a video called about the money behind the war. It's called Exporting Wars. Weapons makers enjoying record 555% shareholder returns as they sabotage the peace talks. Here's a little excerpt from that now.
While visiting the United States, for example, Zelensky enjoyed his stay in Florida. This was several months ago. And he took the time out of his busy presidential schedule to record a video personally thanking BlackRock, thanking JP Morgan, Goldman, and others for their support of Ukraine, for their contribution. And he also added that sending Ukraine heavier weapons represents, quote, a big business opportunity for U.S. corporations. You just can't make that up. Here's the video. Judge for yourself. Take a look and then leave me a comment and let me know what you think about it.
It is obvious that American business can become the locomotive that will once again push forward global economic growth. We have already managed to attract attention and have cooperation with such giants of the international financial and investment world as BlackRock, JP Morgan, and Goldman Sachs. Such American brands as Starlink or Westinghouse have already become part of our Ukrainian way. Your brilliant defense systems, such as HIMARS or Bradleys, are already uniting our history of freedom with your enterprises. We are waiting for Patriots. We are looking closely at Abrams. Thousands of such examples are possible, and everyone can become a big business by working with Ukraine in all sectors, from weapons and defense to construction, from communication to agriculture, from transport to IT, from banks to medicine. And I believe that freedom must always win.
But that's not all. Expect more. The CEO of Rheinmetall is extremely hopeful, indicating that his company profits will continue to rise. According to Financial Times, Chief Executive Armin Papperger, and I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his last name, but he said profitability had increased, quote, significantly due to the boost in sales, which he expected would continue to rise annually by roughly 2 billion euros in the coming years. He's also known as a loud proponent for military support for Kyiv. Of course, why wouldn't he be? He's also quite notorious for his announcement of plans to build a string of factories in Ukraine focused on tank maintenance, munitions, and air defense. Of course, I'm assuming that those plans are not going to come true given the situation with energy. Given where Ukraine stands with energy production capacity, those plans were nothing but a shameless attempt to potentially support Ukraine's status as a rump state used to produce yet more billions for Rheinmetall's shareholders. The CEO of Rheinmetall is certainly enjoying nice pay as well. According to some sources, in 2024, his total compensation includes a salary of 1.3 million euros. While Rheinmetall's total shareholder return surged over the past 3 years, and it surged 555%.
Well, there's obviously a Russian agent on YouTube peddling terrible misinformation there. Lena Petrova is her name. But, I mean, Martin, this is a major factor in this, both with the Palestine war, obviously, and in Ukraine, is our Western economies seem to have hit the buffers. We can't compete with the Chinese. We can't seem to manufacture anything anymore. One of the things we can do is charge vast amounts for public utilities like gas, water, electricity, transport, this sort of thing, energy as well. And we can just about make a little bit of money that way. But the other way to make money when your economy is falling through the floor is manufacturing weapons.
Yeah, we've become totally addicted to weapons manufacture as that's all we do, really.
Do you remember Philip Agee and his brilliant piece, I think it was The Warfare State, he did, and I think it was maybe early 1990s, talking about the United States, is that you end up with an economy which is just totally predicated on weapons production.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's always been the way that the Pentagon tried to make sure that every congressional district has got some military facility in it, so that everybody's got, you know, an interest in supporting the arms expenditure, and the real driving force behind all of this is private profit by shareholders and so on. But the downside of it is that it leads to a totally disorganised military-industrial complex, which is basically driven more by cost-plus. They get cost-plus contracts, so they don't even have to worry about keeping costs down. Whereas in Russia, because it was a socialist country, you've got a nationalised arms industry, ultimately run by generals, which then decide what they want, and then they instruct the industry to go away and do it. And it's just, that's a more efficient, that is the way to have an arms industry if you want it to work. The Western system, we can see it's brutally exposed. The Western way of warfare is incredibly destructive, but we haven't won anything, nothing. The only successful military operation by the US since World War II was probably Grenada, and even that, they had some problems overturning the Cuban defenders.
Just to wind up on Palestine now, J.D. Vance is the Trump vice president pick for this presidential election, and who's going to become emperor of the great Anglo-Zionist Empire at the end of this year. J.D. Vance's mentor co-founded a company that helps Israel genocide the kill lists, generate kill lists of Palestinians to kill in Gaza. So there you go, right in the middle of the Trump presidency. But there's also been this horrific assault this week on the West Bank. We quite often forget about the West Bank, don't we?
Yes, if anybody's confused, the West Bank is not run by Hamas, it's run by Fatah. And yet Israel continues to steal more land to build more settlements, which are illegal under international law. And brutal, the settlers themselves will run rampage through Palestinian towns, setting fire to cars, smashing windows, burning down houses, evicting people from their land, driving farmers off their land. I mean, I've been there three times, and it was sort of in slow motion there, and it speeded up. There's no justification whatsoever for what's happening there. The settlements are illegal under international law. The route of the wall is illegal under international law. The apartheid road network and dual legal system is illegal under international law. Israel shouldn't be there, I mean, even under their own terms. And that's the clinching proof that what is going on is nothing to do with some freedom fighters in a hole in Gaza. This is about Israel continuing a brutal, racist, supremacist, settler colonial project. And it's supported by the West right from its inception. Britain said, we will create a little Ulster in the midst of the Mohammedans. And that's why Britain passed the Balfour Declaration, which interestingly was opposed by the only Jewish minister on the cabinet at the time. Go and look up the history. It's shockingly clear.
Israel stepped up its assault on the West Bank. At least 18 Palestinians have been killed. The violence brings the total number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank since the 7th of October to 668. Israeli operations expanded on Thursday during the second day of Israel's largest attack on this part of the occupied territory since the Second Intifada. News agency Wafa says at least 18 Palestinians have been killed since the assault early on Wednesday. It's focused on the northern areas of the West Bank. With the Israeli forces withdrew from Tablus but expanded an assault on Jenin. So Islamic Jihad has confirmed some of their fighters have been killed in Tulkarm, Nur Shams refugee camp, saying they died after a heroic battle against the soldiers of the occupation, Martin. And of course, you know, we have to remind ourselves, actually, this is occupied land by the Israelis. These people are just simply defending their own territory.
Well, that's what the International Court of Justice has ruled. And of course, it was true anyway. I mean, those who are in occupation have no right of self-defence. They're supposed to, you know, it's supposed to be a temporary measure. You're not supposed to bring in your own nationals to take over other people's land. And, you know, the Israeli state was recognised in 1948 within borders which they immediately ignored and seized further land. And, of course, they seized further land in 1967, including Jerusalem. Now, they're not supposed to be in Jerusalem at all. They're just not supposed to be there. The original conception of a Jewish homeland in Palestine was it would be, you know, Greater Tel Aviv. That was what it was supposed to be. But, of course, they've then interpreted that. But God says we can have Jerusalem. Yeah, but the international law doesn't say you can have it. So when we were talking last week about Gavir going onto the Temple Mount, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, they call it the Temple Mount. It's not even clear it is the Temple Mount. He's not supposed to be there at all, Tony. So he said, well, why can't we pray up here? Well, A, because it doesn't belong to you. There's an agreement surrounding the Waqf, as they call it, that runs Al-Aqsa Mosque, is run by the Jordanian monarchy. And it's not, you know, the Israelis have no right to be there at all. But, of course, this is, you know, this is in the West, it's presumed, well, surely they've got to be allowed to have Jerusalem. It's like, no. Ultimately, I think what's happening now is that the two-state solution is dying the death in front of our eyes. I'm not saying that, you know, the Russians and the Chinese are still talking in those terms, but I can't see, after all this, that the Israeli state can be allowed to continue to exist. It's going to have to be liquidated, just as Algerie Française was liquidated in the 1950s, just as Portuguese colonial rule in Angola and Mozambique was liquidated. And if that means people just have to go somewhere else, if they don't want to live under Palestinian rule, then that means they just have to go somewhere else. That's what happened.
Apparently, Sarah Wilkinson, previously. I mean, this is very important, isn't it? You know, whether the people have been released or not. Sarah Wilkinson's been denied bail, apparently. Police came to her house, and so she's set up some sort of a GoFundMe account to try and help her costs of being arrested and being under the worst kind of bail conditions are. Maybe she has been released under bail.
What's she been charged with?
Supporting Hamas, the Terrorism Act, anyone that speaks in any way to support the Palestinian army. I think maybe that's what we should
start. It's not the Palestinian army, it's the Palestinian government. Yeah? That's what we're talking about. And of course, they are negotiating with them indirectly in Cairo and Doha. So we're not allowed to talk about them, except we are talking to them. The only solution is to talk to Hamas. That's the only solution. They don't want to do it, but they've got to do it.
Anyway, Roland, I wonder if you could just give us a link to, if people are interested in following you, your Palestine Solidarity websites, that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's the Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Just Google that. And there's Bristol Palestine Alliance. You've heard Palestine Action being talked about. They have a website. And, get involved, get in touch. Been part of a group that's actually done 38 rallies on the centre every Friday evening from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock over the last 10 months. There was one happening this evening when I was setting off to come over here instead. They will happen in response to current events. There was a combined one this evening, including one by health workers who are concerned about the constant attack on health personnel in Gaza, which is beyond unjustifiable. And Bristol Palestine Alliance has done, I think it's 18 major marches and rallies, College Green or Castle Park, around the town centre, We've also supported the students who were very bravely in occupation. They had a protest camp up at the university. If you wonder why that was, it's because, and you can look it up, Bristol University has over £92 million of involvement with arms companies. And students say, quite rightly, I thought universities were about education. We shouldn't be doing that. That's not what education should be all about. They were very brave people, and they will be restarting a campaign this autumn, I understand. And we wish them well.
I wonder if there's any, either of you, like to chip in with any thoughts about ways out of this piece. Roland?
I didn't quite finish.
Sorry.
Bristol is unique, almost in the Western world, to have a Palestine museum just off the centre, run by volunteers, like many, many excellent organisations here in our city, open every weekend, Saturdays and Sundays. Check it out. Opened by the Palestine ambassador and the Lord Mayor of Bristol 11 years ago, I believe, and going from strength to strength. And obviously it's an incredible resource. It's free. It's open every weekend, full of historical and cultural information. Check that out. If you haven't been yet, you really need to. It's something Bristol can be really, really proud of. And in terms of what makes Bristol special, last weekend a group of us were invited up by Massive Attack to the event the Downs. Yeah. We were actually specifically asked to bring our Palestine flags. They wanted to see them in the audience, despite, you know, security searching people's bags, and I think umbrellas weren't allowed, but our flags were. It was incredible lineup, incredible gig, and Massive Attack, of course, a very outspoken supporter of Palestine.
Haven't they released
a
ceasefire single or something?
I don't follow these things in detail, but I'm very glad to hear that.
I was looking for it. I'm sure, being Massive Attack, I'm sure it would be wonderful.
Be glad to be in Bristol, the city that likes to stand on the right side of history.
I keep talking about this these recently as ways forward, because these Abrahamic faiths, it's quite obvious to me, someone is coming in, very, very evil people are coming in with crowbars trying to come between the Zionists, the Jewish particularly, and the Muslims. At the site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So my solution is a very simple one. Allow prayers of the Jews at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Allow prayers of Muslims at the Wailing Wall. This is the way, I think, you know, Martin probably think I'm being very naive here, but this is a way to say, well, you know, if you're going to turn up here to pray rather than with a gun, fine.
Well, the point is, this was made by Thomas Suarez last week, nobody in Gaza can go to Jerusalem. They can't leave Gaza. Nobody in the West Bank can get to
Jerusalem. That's got nothing to do with what I was saying.
No, really, but how can they pray in their own mosque? Because they're not allowed to move in their own country.
Then no one else. No,
Israelis that are praying there are not supposed to be there.
This is a beggar thy neighbour attitude.
It is.
If you want to have some peace and reconciliation,
Tony,
you're going to have to make a few concessions if you want peace.
You're turning everything into prayer, Tony. And this
isn't
prayer.
I'm not turning everything into prayer. No. What I'm saying is, do you want to reconcile Muslims and Jews in Jerusalem or not?
No, I want the Jews out.
Right, okay. Well, I think you've made that pretty clear.
Can I come in on this? It's nothing to do with religion. Let's remind ourselves, where was Jesus born? Begins with B, Bethlehem. Where is Bethlehem? It's in the West Bank, just behind the wall. And a lot of the people who live in that town are Christians, and they get as badly treated as the Muslim Palestinians. I've been there, I've seen with my own eyes.
The Christian Zionists don't seem to get that, do they?
No, well, they're on a planet all of their own.
They certainly are. Hopefully very, very far away from Earth. Anyway, Roland, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Send the mothers back to work. Let the school system parent your children right from the birth. Make a meal, feed them pills, confuse them about what's real. Tell them facts don't really matter, it's all about how you feel. Science and math are racist, history let's erase it. Indoctrinate a whole generation, you can't escape it. It's bigger than American politics, you're an accomplice. White people racist and bigots and you're a colonist. If you want freedom, we'll encourage to do the opposite. It's toxic masculinity, if a man is too confident. Excuse me, what's a woman? Well, I am not a biologist. Common sense is really not common when you're a communist. Parents that care about their kids, let's call them terrorists. It's cool to be a feminist and an environmentalist. If you love the country, that makes you a white supremacist. Don't even try defending it, cause what you say's irrelevant. Put your hands up, everybody stand up.
better not be in here telling these children that men can't get pregnant.
Of course not, Mr. Smith.
And did you tell all the white children that they are racist?
And colonizers and bigots, yes.
Very good. Go and put your hands up, everybody stand up. The whole world going mad, bro. 2 + 2 = 5. You a homophobe if you don't think that adds up. Don't have children. If you do, then abort them. If your neighbors don't comply with the government, then report them. If you have independent thoughts, then just ignore them. Communism's the way, democracy is too boring. Bring your kids to a drag show. Give them a couple dollars to put right up in their asshole. Don't worry about the Epstein flight logs. The case is closed, so don't even go and ask, bro. Trust the WHO and CDC. None of our politicians work for the CCP. White kids are born racist. If you disagree, that makes you a damn racist. Study CRT. In today's lesson, men can get pregnant. Put your hands down, no more questions. Don't say pedophile, just say ALA. Adults that like adolescents. Go and put your hands up, everybody stand up. The whole world going mad, bruh. 2 + 2 = 5. You a racist if you don't think that add up. Go and put your hands up, everybody stand up. The whole world going mad, bruh. 2 + 2 = 5. You a homophobe if you don't think that adds up.
We want to drive the whole world crazy. Brainwash kids from the top. Babies, we want you dependent and lazy. They never learn honestly. It amazes.
Go and put your hands up, everybody stand up. The whole world going mad, bruh. 2 + 2 = 5. You a racist if you don't think that add up. Go and put your hands up, everybody stand up. The whole world going mad, bruh. 2 + 2 = 5. You a homophobe if you don't think that adds up.
What's up, y'all? Thank you for watching my brand new music video, 2 + 2 = 5. If you can, check out the description box below, click that link, and grab yourself a t-shirt. Common sense is in common when you're a communist. I appreciate y'all.
So that's Roberta Flack there, 1971, first time ever I saw your face. I only realised recently that was written by Peggy Seeger, who had a long collaboration with Ewan McColl, who were, I mean, they were both fantastic. Ewan did this whole thing called, these things called the Radio Ballads. If you've never come across them, do check them out. They're all sorts of compilations of mostly traditional sort of folk music, like he did one to do with the songs sung by the miners and little interviews with miners as the coal industry was being destroyed, and the same with the fishing industry. And there's a really good one to do with the travellers as well, travelling people, itinerant labourers, now of course replaced by cheap migrant labour these days, doing things like fruit picking. But anyway, Ewan McColl and Peggy Seeger, Peggy wrote that, he wrote it, did he write it for her or did she write it for him? But anyway, that was not them, it was Roberta Flack singing it. And before that we had good old Hi Rez. That song is called 2 + 2 = 5. And so welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We'll start straight away, Martin, with this business of the F-16. Warren Thornton is tweeting, shot down by a Patriot in Ukraine.
Well, obviously this is just breaking news today. The F-16s have been given to the Ukrainians.
Mostly by the Dutch, I think.
I'm not quite sure who gave them to, but obviously, as the Russians said, if you bring them in here, we are going to destroy them. And one has been destroyed, but it looks like it's by friendly fire.
Is this what Zelensky means when he says all this wonderful technology is going to generate lots and lots of new orders for F-16s if the Russians are shooting them down?
Well, I think this is the problem. I mean, obviously there is money to be made, as we were discussing earlier, for the military-industrial complex in the West by pretending to supply the Ukrainians with stuff, even if they don't get it. As long as they're paid for it, they don't care, really. But it's none of it's going to make any difference to
Do you know what an F-16 costs?
I've no idea. More than 10 shilling.
As it rolls off the production line? Go on, have a guess, Martin. Come on.
I don't know.
Come on.
20 million?
$575 million.
Well, there we are.
For a nice new F-16. So that's what the replacement value of that one, which was shot down allegedly by a Patriot. So it was apparently destroyed during a Russian attack. So I'm imagining what the Ukrainians are doing is they're firing off these Patriot missiles, which aren't able to identify as friend or foe aircraft flying around, and maybe this F-16 didn't have the right sort of electronic tag on it, and Patriot has accidentally shot it down.
Yeah, there's another theory running around that in fact it was a Kinzhal missile that destroyed the F-16, because it comes in. So what they do is they've got missiles coming in, they want to get into the air, and as they're trying to get into the air, the missile hits them because it's actually coming in too fast for them. I don't know the truth of it. I mean, we're obviously, you know, we're inevitably, to a certain extent, you know, having a bit of fog of war here, not least because both sides are trying to obfuscate what's going on for their own reasons.
Just going back briefly to the arrest of Richard Medhurst, also of the Palestine Action attack on Elbit, of the arrest of the founder of Palestine Action, for Sarah Wilkinson arrest. Virtually no coverage of this at all in the British press at all. And you would have thought the journalists might be interested in if other journalists are being arrested.
Well, you might, but then there's plenty of people who just want to keep their jobs and keep their heads down, isn't there?
It seems very controlled. The whole thing seems extremely controlled. So no one, doesn't really matter if journalists are being arrested just for stating facts.
Well, I mean, obviously it matters to people like us.
So is this why the mainstream media's got such a problem with fake news? It's because they're not allowed to state the facts?
Well, this is a constant struggle going on to get access to genuine information and to cut through the narrative and psychological warfare games that are being played.
How long can they continue with this?
Well, if they're going to carry on with it all the way, aren't they? What's going to happen in the end is I think that the Russians are going to win decisively. They're going to win the war, and then they'll find it very hard to explain to the ordinary population in the West what it was all about and why we bothered to fight it. But of course, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we come.
I do. I mean, this is what we decided to tell you tonight. You know, from the newsprint. One of the other things they're not telling us at all about is the number of Israelis who are trying to get out of the country. Let's have a listen to a report now on that. Now,
if the situation will be so bad, it's worsening every day. We will find a place to live outside Israel. We all have European passports.
And others also think of emigrating, as hardline ministers push through highly controversial laws that would weaken oversight of the government by the courts.
Unfortunately, many, many of my friends check the options in other countries.
I will not raise my kids in a country which is not democratic.
Today, Israelis are getting a taste of their own medicine, and by all accounts, they don't like it. And because the Middle East is not their native home, they are grabbing their American or European passports and heading quickly for the exits, telling a waiting journalist how terrifying it has become to illegally occupy another people's land.
I just had the worst experience of my life. I was in quarantine and I heard the rockets go off and my whole life changed.
This underscores the point that Palestinians have been yelling at the top of their voices for years, that Jewish settlers have the luxury of running to their countries of origin when times get tough, whereas Palestinians have nowhere else to go.
He's making a good point there, Martin, isn't he? There's complete freedom of movement, actually, for the Israeli citizens.
Yeah, many of them have dual passports or are capable of getting dual passports.
And apparently up to 2 million have either gone already or are thinking about or making plans to leave.
Yes, and the longer this goes on, the more unviable Israel as a state becomes.
I remember Tim Cohen, the Christian Zionist author, saying it may at some point be time to get out of Dodge.
Yes, well, I mean, sadly, it's the more liberal-minded Israelis who are fleeing first, because A, they've got the resources, and B, they're the ones who are least committed to what's going on. There will always be the state is becoming unviable. Let's put it that way. As things stand, the whole of northern Israel, which is under Hezbollah attack, they can't live.
It sounds like
anymore.
Bristol going bankrupt.
Well, it's a bit more serious than that,
yes,
isn't it?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Why is this all happening at the same time?
Because it's a global crisis happens on every level. If there is a major Iranian attack on Israel, which everybody's expecting, and that escalates, the oil price is going to go through the roof and everything's going to go bankrupt. This is what happened at the beginning of the First World War in 1914. The war broke out in August 1914. It started to get going. All the stock markets collapsed. And then the governments had to take over running the economy. This is what's going to happen. I'm pretty certain that's what's going to happen.
Well, shut me up, the government's really competent to do that.
Well, no, they're not really competent to do it, but therefore there will then be a mess, won't there? And Bristol City Council will go bankrupt. Loads of local councils will go bankrupt. All sorts of things will go bankrupt. All sorts of businesses will go bankrupt. And people will lose their jobs.
You know what I think actually should really be the top news of this week is this interesting arrest of the Telegram boss, Paul Durov, on Saturday. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you'd seen this, Martin, yeah. but apparently it was one of the French media outlets. I'm just trying to find it now. I think it's called Canard, Le Canard Enchant. I don't know, never heard of them, have you?
It's a satirical weekly. It means that the chained duck.
Okay. So anyway, they're saying that they've picked up from Durov's associates that he was actually flying to France because he'd been invited to dinner with Macron.
Well, he got on the plane without...
Or off?
On the plane in Dubai.
This is his own private jet.
Yes. And they didn't issue the arrest warrant until he was in the air and on his way to France. So he presumed that he was going to be okay.
I mean, if what this magazine is saying is correct, this is really interesting, isn't it? The idea that you could invite him, it's almost as if you're trying to say, right, we need to cut a deal here. But actually, you're not really going to cut a deal. All you're going to do is slap him in irons.
Well, I think one of the major...
This is medieval style.
It may be that the Israelis have some hand in this, because Telegram has been used. You know, he refuses to... give access to intelligence services and police forces to Telegram. He says it's encrypted. People can, you know, I'm in favour of freedom of speech. He left Russia because he didn't want the, you know, because the
everybody's the, after him, mate.
The Russians said, well, you know, we will want to be able to, you know, use your, you know, and he said, well, I'm not going
to use
do
it.
That.
I mean, I think the idea is that they want to monitor it. They want back doors into it.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And this, of course, is the point with Facebook and Twitter, is they do have back doors into it. And that's why people like Zuckerberg and Elon Musk are able to trot around the world anytime they want. It's because they've opened up their platforms to the National Security Agency, GCHQ, and anybody else
in
the Western Five Eyes.
And that's what Durov has refused
to
do.
Spy on people.
That's what Durov has refused to do.
Yeah, he has.
But of course, both Telegram and TikTok are in the sites because they are spreading what the West regards as misinformation about Israel and the war in the Ukraine.
Well, actually,
and in actual fact, what they're doing is providing what the other social media
platforms
pretend.
They're trying to control the narrative, and actually Telegram is not controlling the narrative. My own Telegram channel, I think, does a reasonable job. Sometimes people post nonsense on there, I delete it and ban them. But, you know, this is no reason to ban it. He's doing a fantastic job, I think.
It just shows that even being a squillionaire like he is doesn't mean that you can escape being bullied by these forces.
No, or tricked by them. So the Russian's Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson, Maria Zakharova, criticised the French authorities for their double standards. I just remembered that in 2018, a group of 26 NGOs, including Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Freedom House, Freedom House, Reporters Without Borders, the Committee to Protect Journalists and others, condemned a Russian court's decision to block Telegram. The West made other similar statements, Zakharova said. Telegram's played an important role in the ongoing information war surrounding the genocide in Gaza. And very important, isn't it? Last week, Haaretz reported, of course, I say of course, but this could be the actual reason for it, that Telegram has proved a massive challenge for Israel since the start of the war. This includes sensitive data leaks from Israel acquired by hackers and released on Telegram channels. The Israel newspaper noted, while many tech firms have streamlined mechanisms through which states can reach out to them to censor content, Telegram is considered the least cooperative of them all. So there's a leak from the Department of Justice in Israel, which has possibly been hacked information from the Israeli government, which has been shared on Telegram. And even though Telegram has now shut down that channel, I think it was called DDoS, something like that, distributed denial service attack, basically like a kind of version of WikiLeaks, you know, so they're spreading some of these leaks what is it? This is information which is about war crimes, potentially, and corruption from governments. And this possibly is simply, again, orders from Israel. This is why Telegram's boss has been arrested in France.
That's what I was thinking. I mean, there's a general assault going on, as we know, on those who are, you know, dissing the Israeli perspective on what's going on, and they're getting more desperate about it as they get more desperate.
Yeah, so Israel has been successful in controlling and censoring information on other social media apps, including Instagram, Facebook, X and TikTok, via the lobbying of Cyberwell, an NGO with extensive links to Israeli intelligence. On the 23rd of August, Resistance News Network's Telegram channel was banned across the EU, prompting them to activate their backup. On 16th of August, Facebook and Instagram's parent company Meta permanently banned The Cradle, which I'm reading this to you from its social media platforms for violating community guidelines by praising terrorist organisations and engaging in incitements to violence. It does seem to me that as the war on the battlefield in Gaza grinds to a halt, and other things are tried, like let's kill a load of people over in the West Bank, or let's try and start a riot in Britain using our little agent Tommy Robinson, that this is something that they can actually say, well, we're achieving something even though we've lost on the battlefield, Martin.
Well, I mean, the attempts to control the narrative by both the Ukrainians and the Israelis are ongoing. And, you know, they take it very seriously because they need, you know, they need at least to neutralise opposition to what they're doing. And, you know, they are the enemies of freedom of speech, as we know. I mean, David Miller was a tenured professor at Bristol University. They went after his scalp and they got it. And they, you know, they are determined to silence those that they don't agree with. That's obvious.
Six preliminary charges against Durov. This is a backlash, apparently, since the charging head of a tech platform, the activity of its users has chilling implications for free speech. One of the preliminary charges is for managing an online platform to allow illicit transactions by organised group. Mm-hmm. Organised group? Maybe they mean organised criminals, which could lead to up to 10 years in prison and a 500,000 euro fine. Durov's accused of not cooperating with investigations into illegal activity on Telegram. So apparently he's been released on bail on Wednesday, a 5 million euros bail. He's not allowed to leave France and must check in at a police station twice a week. He's kind of getting towards a kind of Assange type situation.
Well, I don't think he's as admirable as Assange, because he is basically a billionaire top.
Doesn't matter how much money he's got in his bank account, does it? He's annoying people by releasing hacked material of crimes.
Well, what he's doing is he's not cooperating with them in the way and of course he's in favour of, you know, people are going to say what they want to say on my platform. It's, you know, it's a freedom of speech platform. I mean, it's quite odd because he's no longer a citizen of Russia. I think he's a citizen of Dubai. I don't think he's got French citizenship.
Well, we heard earlier on. I think he's got several passports.
Yes, so in other words, but it's still a bit bizarre that the French should decide that they are going to be the ones to drag him over the coals. But I don't, you know, I mean, we're still an ongoing story. We don't know everything about this yet.
Anyway, fascinating. See how that goes and see if my Telegram channel is allowed to continue. Thank you very much, by the way, Pavel Durov, for creating Telegram. You've done a fantastic job with it. I'm hoping that other people will understand what he's... I mean, of course, he's getting to the point, Martin, where he's becoming more and more profitable. He's adding new features to this, and it is potentially going to become the biggest social media platform in the world.
Yes, especially if people know that they get freedom of speech on there and they can't get it on the others, you know, because that's the competition, isn't it?
Yeah. So on RT, talking of censored stuff, RT is banned in Britain, but today or yesterday, the RT broadcaster, I thought, very interesting interview with the Russian ambassador to London, Andrei Kelin. So let's have a little listen to that now. He is talking about what he thinks of the British economy.
All answers, I think a lot of answers to it are laying in yesterday's speech by the Prime Minister Starmer over there, because he has concentrated himself on the domestic issues, what is happening, inheritance of conservatives was, it provides a very great future for United Kingdom economy, especially it has fallen down from the big, from the 10 biggest industrialized most industrialized countries. It is the worst performance among Big Seven now by the UK. All of this is transferring itself in big unemployment, poor economic performances, inflation, and on and on and on. The answers to that from the previous conservative government lay in the foreign policy correctly. They are saying that Russia is to blame for every failure of the conservative government. Of course, it is, I would say, crazy. It's an idea that does not have any grounds at all. I haven't heard so far that Russia is to blame for these failures from the new Labour government, but probably it will follow.
He's right, quite cynically saying, well, they're going to blame us for everything that happens. And, of course, they are already blaming them for the gas, not supplying gas, although they're saying that the Russians blew up their own pipeline, the Nord Stream. Oh, is that what they're trying to say? But he's pointing out, Martin, actually, that Britain is in a terrible state economically, an absolute disaster.
Well, it's performing worse than other G7 countries, and there's a number of factors that have led to that. You know, I mean, Liz Truss was not really going to help. You know, she you know, on her own caused an enormous loss of resources. I mean, she basically cost the country billions. And, you know, lots of poor decisions have been made over the years in this country because we've become a rentier economy run by rentiers.
And those decisions are now Starmer's decisions, aren't they?
Yes, and of course, he's just, what he's done with the speech this week is to try and, you know, dampen expectations that they can do anything because it's the situation so dire. And of course, it's going to get more dire because because Keir Starmer is going to escalate the war in the Middle East because that's what the Americans want. And that will, as I say, force up the price of oil and gas, which will then lead to stock market crashes and so on. Rachel Reeves's sums all depend upon everything just carrying on as is at the moment.
Yeah, well, if everything carries on as is at the moment, in a couple of years' time, there'll be nothing left of this country because there'll just be no government and everything will be...
Well, there'll still be the government.
Well, will there? Yeah, I mean, of course there will, but I mean, what they're constantly saying is we've got no money to do this and do that. Anyway, one of the other people who are victims of all these shenanigans are farmers, and I was given called up by an old colleague from the around about 2000-2002 recently. He's done what he's called a timeline of rewilding. Now, this whole rewilding idea we talked about briefly with Isaac earlier. Rewilding is the idea of setting bits of farmland aside for wild animals. This is great, of course, but the only thing is that this was being done anyway. So I put together a piece this week, which I'll share with you on the newsletter on the Land Is Ours website. And this is really looking at the context of rewilding. What is going on? Where is it from? Well, it turns out, of course, it's just another thing that's come from the World Economic Forum. And the actual object of it is to make farms unprofitable so that then they have to be sold, the land has to be sold, and they can be snapped up by the likes of Bill Gates and private equity. So let's have a listen now to a video which is linked in the report, the rewilding timeline, and this one's called Farmland Wars.
We've been caught in the middle of a war, America. And it's not ending anytime soon. It's a war for control between nationalists and globalists. And for American conservatives who believe in the Constitution and just want to live in a free world, time is running out. Their path to power is clear. And they're well on their way. They know that if they can control the food...
Thousands of farmers have been taken to the streets of Sri Lanka for weeks to protest a ban on imports of chemical fertilizer.
If they control our energy...
If they don't try and put this energy crisis under control, that there will be rationing when it comes to this winter, that there could be even social unrest...
They control our wealth.
Well, reining in the, quote, wild west of crypto, those comments coming from the EU, as it agreed to landmark regulation in the crypto space.
Then they will also control the people. It's happening all over the world, and it's already happening here, too.
Bill Gates became the largest individual owner of farmland in America.
Tonight, I will show you the steps both globalists and nationalists around the world are taking to control your life forever. Tonight, Farmland Wars, the global takeover of America's land.
Heavy-hitting investors like BlackRock are buying up at a record-shattering amount of U.S. homes. They're not the only ones. For farms and ranches, it's people like Bill Gates. This graphic shows Bill Gates' footprint on American farmland. Now, what is it that he knows that you and I don't know? He's nearing 300,000 acres spread out all over the country of farmland. He's never really struck me as a guy with a pitchfork. Current farmers being aged and priced out of their land, Gates, his total is only going to go up. Now, I wonder what old Bill might do with all that land. Well, listen to this.
Well, the Gates Foundation has partnered with DFID on a great number of things, and among those are work we do together on livestock, helping animals survive either by having vaccines or better genetics, helping them be more productive. It's making a big difference.
Oh, so vaccinating and screwing with the genetics of livestock. Oh, that's great. I mean, I totally trust the Gates on this one, don't you? The food supply is perfectly safe.
So that's a view from Glenn Beck, the conservative media sort of, well, I mean, he's a propagandist, I suppose, over in the States. But the fact is, Martin, that the super rich are not just doing nothing with the money. They're not just putting it in the bank, are they? They're putting it into farms.
Well, I mean, obviously, there's farm wars are going on all over the world, Tony, and they've been going on for quite a long time. In Nicaragua, the main goal of the revolution was to redistribute the land. And, of course, they eventually did it. But it was an armed struggle. It was an armed struggle against US-backed terrorists.
I was talking about Zimbabwe earlier, wasn't
it? Yes, well, yes, similar issues there. And, of course, the US has used its farm sector by subsidising it as a way of trying to control the rest of humanity by controlling the world's food supply. They basically use USAID aid in a country like Bangladesh. They give lots of so-called free aid, which actually undermines the local farmers, but it actually makes Bangladesh dependent on US food, which means that when it comes to, you know, votes in the United Nations about things like invading Iraq, Bangladesh knows which side its bread's buttered on, quite literally. And, you know, all farming around the world, especially in developed countries, is basically subsidised farming. If there was a free market in farming, there wouldn't be much farming in a country like Britain. So if we have it at all, it's because we want to have it.
Yeah, well, because we want to actually make sure that people can have something to eat.
You want to have food security in the sense that's like in the Second World War. But on the other hand, both the US and the EU dump its agricultural services on the rest of the world, which actually undermines their food security. So what we do need is land reform in developing countries, which probably means armed struggle against landlords in places like Brazil. And that's not really on the agenda of Glenn Beck and all of his chums.
You always
the idea that it's going to be no.
You always seem to go for armed struggles.
Well, I'm pointing out is that Glenn Beck and all of these conservatives in the US.
What's actually happening here is financial institutions just buying this stuff up. There's no armed struggle going on.
No, but at some point you'll have to take it back off them, and you won't necessarily want to pay for it. The problems that I have with the Jeff Beck kind of a perspective on these things is that they're very aware of what they think is controlling things, and then you just point out obvious stuff like the US has basically been repressing peasant movements all over the world since World War II. Well, are you on the side of the peasants? Is he on the side of the Viet Cong?
Well,
probably not.
In this, certainly in the piece that I put together, and this chap has. Yes. Martin, we're not talking about that now. I'm just saying about this Rewilding piece. We're not talking about Jeff Beck now. He's pointing out that the World Economic Forum is where this whole Rewilding thing came from. He's also saying that global profiles, powerful people in there are people like Nicolas Sarkozy, Bill Gates, Bono, Richard Branson, Jorma Orlila, who's from Shell Oil, Jose Manuel Barroso, President of the European Commission. Personal conversation has suggested around half the current members of the Cabinet of the British Parliament. This is the previous government, maybe World Economic Forum trained. And Klaus Schwab, the head, has claimed the World Economic Forum have penetrated many world government cabinets. So it wouldn't be surprising. Anyway, I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But I'll finish this week with something going back to this whole concept of peace and potential peace and what the real agendas are in Jerusalem and the West Bank and Gaza, and leave you with True News. That is Stephen, and is the guy that runs it. I'm not sure of his second name, but anyway, he interviews this rather interesting lady here called Jana Ben-Nun.
When we were talking about the book, I think it was The Secret Doctrine in Israel. Is that the book that you said that there was a 200-year-old prophecy in that book? Or is it another book?
It is a different book. There is a Jewish author, Rabbi Joel Bakst, and he's...
Yes, okay.
Yes, and he's author of a two-volume book. It's called Josephic Messiah, Sacred Serpent, and I think it has like three names. But they are sourcing it from... 200-year-old book called Kol Hator, The Voice of the Turtle Dove. And in that particular book, the rabbi Gaon de Vilna have discovered the code or expressed, or he was able to get the revelation, as they say, of the mystery of Kabbalah. And they have predicted in that book, they said that at the end times, at the messianic times, the figure like Cyrus shall appear again. So all of these Cyrus prophecies...
That was like over 200 years ago?
Yes, it was all over 200 years ago.
There would be a Cyrus figure appear.
Right.
And what would the Cyrus do?
Well, in a Jewish mind, they have not only one Messiah, like we know Christians, we have Jesus Christ as one and the only Messiah. They have two Messiahs. One is a Messiah ben Joseph, and one is Messiah ben David.
They have two?
They have two Messiahs.
One's now, not good enough?
Well, no. This is the way they explain it. The Messiah ben Joseph can be anybody, whether Jew or a Gentile. It can be an Edomite, according to them, a Gentile. But that Gentile has to do good for Israel and move Israel towards its final redemption, Tikkun Olam.
Okay, so several weeks ago, when the before the impeachment trial, and the Lev Parnas recording came out, that was recorded on his partner's phone, Donald Trump was there, and they were telling him, your name is in gematria.
Yes.
You're like the Messiah.
Right, correct.
Okay. So he's the Gentile Messiah?
Yes, according to Jewish doctrine, Messiah ben Joseph can be either a Jew or a Gentile who helps Israel in their redemption process, who is doing anything, all the good things for Israel, so Israel can come to a place where they rule the world.
Well, you have two different points in that. You have the Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. And one brings about Israel through redemption, but the other brings it about through war. And some are believing that that Trump could be possibly the David Messiah, and that Netanyahu could be the Yosef, which brings about the war, or vice versa. I forget now which one's which, but this is and there's all kinds of beliefs out there like this.
Well, it may make it difficult for Trump to be the war Messiah, because the day the U.S. Senate voted to limit his powers to start a war with Iran.
So that's Jonah Ben Nun saying some very interesting things. I mean, the idea that there's going to be like two messiahs, how weird. I think this, for me, points towards, it's very important, folks. You know, I said that thing at the very start of the show. Well, it's not the end of the world, which is one of those things we kind of trot off. But hey, maybe it is the end of the world. Not right now, but maybe this is all coming. And so when these things actually start to take place, you know, such as the emergence of a potential antichrist, you have to kind of understand, well, first of all, the precursor, the model seems to me obviously an Adolf Hitler kind of character. So you've got a world which is in a terrible economic situation, as Germany was back in the early 1930s. And this guy Hitler is presented to the public as a messiah in a way. Yes, of course he was. And a man god. The other thing is, you know, the Islamic, and maybe I should do an interview next week with one of my Islamic correspondents, but, you know, the Islam has its own view of this. Actually, Judaism has its own view of the end of the world too. So they're all talking about it. And I think it's about time that we started taking these things seriously, particularly when, weird things like the mark of the beast start popping up in our everyday lives. You know, this whole idea of a microchip in the forehead, in the right hand, that's going to be used to buy and sell. Well, isn't that weird? You know, you've got your chip and pin, and this one is, it's all happening anyway. So, what I'd like to do as well this week, as well as my little thing I've done on rewilding, at least I've done an introduction to this brilliant, timeline of where it's all come from and where it's all going, who's behind it, i.e. Rebecca Wrigley and her partner George Monbiot, who I used to work with many years ago down in Totnes, being sort of the pushers of all this Trojan horse, the new enclosures by BlackRock and Vanguard and private equity firms. So I'll also put up a link to and some, maybe some extracts from a revelation guide that I did a long, long time ago. It's a kind of Bible study for the book of Revelation, which has got all sorts of interesting bits and bobs in there. About time I shared that with you folks, I think, and I'll put that out on this week's newsletter as an attachment as well. But finally this week, it's Patrizia Opulenza's moment. Her ode this week is, "We plough the fields, they shatter." Very much my sort of rewilding farming crisis thing. "In seeds and weeks and flowers hidden, agenda 30, evil ridden, more lies each day in print we read, or on the MSM live feed. Across our land, farmers bought out or told rewild from trough-like snouts. 4,000 years we've ploughed our land, feeding folk at God's right hand. Now they lie, they lie, they lie, and tell our farmers rewild or die. No reference made of farms of yore, when hand in hand with wildlife saw the CRT with Robin Page, who proved that old school farming paid. Hand in hand with nature showed ways of old with truth bestowed. Then Charlie and his chums of dumb carpetbaggers, plus then some, who want the land to rot and wane so it can be bought up again by greedy, ruthless, evil devils. When there is famine, they will revel. Carbon credits and all that's rotten, Charlie's rent ne'er be forgotten. Vanguard, BlackRock, who hide the wealth of greedy, evil men of stealth, who think they'll live forever and ever, which goes to prove this lot ain't clever." Thank you very much, Patrizia. Lovely. And that's really, it seems, I think, written around this article I did on Tuesday and Wednesday this week, which is an introduction to the rewilding timeline, which I'll share with you all. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to Bristol Palestine Solidarity's Roland Dye, our nuclear expert as well. And of course, to Joe Banks and also to Isaac Kneebone Hopkins, we had right at the beginning. So, also, of course, the sound engineer, Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram for now, anyway. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. And you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter if you can afford it, and you can donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Just a little thought is, I was chatting briefly to Michael Tyler this week, who lives on a canal barge. He's got his own blog, and he did a brilliant piece years ago about Google, because he noticed that over a space of a couple of days, suddenly he was getting no hits on his website. And looking into it, he realised that no, Google had just was experimenting with taking his and many other radical-ish websites out of the search engine. And people don't know what they've not been told. If you search on Google and Google have taken one of those, or 10 of them, results out, you don't know that. But anyway, he's done, and I'll put a link up to it as well this week, an update on his dead bankers. And I think this is prompted by the boat being probably blown up over in Sicily with Mike Lynch and the banker there that died from Morgan Stanley. His name, I can't remember right this second, but anyway, I'll put a link up to that as well, Mike's update on his dead bankers list too. So we've been streaming live from the Eastone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know. I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
why they're telling me it's not my concern. But when I see children cry, 'cause that's all they can do, they are crying for help and they're looking at you. What are you supposed to do? Another bomb becomes diffused, and the terrorists aren't amused. Paisley is getting his shirt off, Sinn Féin are going insane. They strive to divide the countryside, but the borderline remains. Another attack leaves a widow with black, grieving for her bereaved. Another kid with a brick gets shot in the back and gets left on the pavement. Right through me.
CBS Miami affiliate WFOR as we continue watching the situation at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. What officials have described as a mass casualty incident, a shooting at that school. Students continue to file out, and some, in some cases, remain huddled inside classrooms.
I only care about the lives, I don't care about the politics. Every single day waking up a holocaust with a hollow tip. Politician only concerned about getting paper, treating the people like we strangers. God forbid it happened to that kid, they will understand all this anger. They glorify you in the rap music videos and all of the movies. Kids getting shot in classrooms while they writing down on a loose leaf. Cops killing people, people killing cops too. It's easy just to look the other way when it's someone else and not you. The news acting like they give a shit. They're not the ones that have to live with this. They need tragedy to sell stories. Honestly, I'm so sick of it. In class, writing down bullet points, getting hit with the bullet points. It doesn't matter left wing or right, they just look for someone that they could exploit.
We are prey. The sewing secret day. When everything's okay. We want change. Looking for a better place where the skies are never gray. Yeah.
Some people blame the shooter, other people blame the gun. But it's clear to me, it should be clear to you, that the fault is more than one. It's about mental health, politicians getting wealth. Every single tragedy, the press eats it up in its cells. You took the life of a couple friends and my little cousin too. I don't want my son or daughter growing up where they scared to go to school. But that's the world that we living in, wish it wasn't true. I realized I was selfish, hoping it was someone else and not you. Damn, I don't have no solution, I'm just speaking my mind. I'm just so sick and tired of the blind leading the blind. It's easier to get a gun than it is to go and get a job. That's why I don't get surprised when I see people getting robbed. R.I.P. to my cousin and a couple of my friends. A lot of people just waving you around like it's nothing to them. I won't go and blame the president, I won't even blame you. All the people that's pointing fingers need to take the blame too.
We are praying. It's only see a day when everything's okay. Yeah. We want change. Looking for a better place where the skies are never gray. Yeah.
And so these pictures that we're seeing, as shocking as they are, to see these kids walking out of school with their hands on their heads or their hands on someone's shoulders, law enforcement sadly has become accustomed to scenes like this. So they have a plan in place.